You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford with the February 22nd edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month, every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Today happens to be the third anniversary of the success of the U.S. orchestrated coup in Ukraine, the day when the country's lawfully elected President Viktor Yanukovych fled the capital of Kiev, fearing for his life. It was also the event that kicked off the current wave of anti-Russia hysteria, which is unlike anything I recall seeing even during the height of the Cold War. This time, however, in a world turned upside down by the election of Donald Trump, it is for the most part liberals who are the most hysterical. It is one of the issues I plan to raise with today's guest, veteran Dutch journalist Carl van Wolferen, at 20 minutes past the hour. It will be a continuation of my conversation with van Wolferen, a keen observer of the U.S. political scene, begun but abbreviated on my last program, about his recent article, Karl Rove's Prophecy, in the UNS Review, How the Political Establishment Manufactures the Realities It Chooses. It is pertinent to what happened in Ukraine because Wolferen points out, quote, the neocon state put in the State Department and other positions closely linked to the Obama White House, where they became allies with the liberal hawks in continuing spreading democracy, in quotes, by overthrowing regimes. America's mainstream news and opinion purveyors, without demurring, he wrote, accommodated the architects of reality production overseen by Dick Cheney, end quote. And if you have been listening to NPR, you'll see it is on the same bandwagon as it was in pushing for the invasion of Iraq in 2003. But who would have expected such liberals as Michael Moore, Bill Moyers, and groups such as Move On, Common Cause, Color of Change, and the alternative websites Common Dreams and Alternet would be in the forefront of those leading the anti-Russian campaign that originated in the nonsensical, unproven, and unprovable allegation that Russia, under Vladimir Putin's personal direction, interfered with the presidential elections and delivered the White House to Donald Trump. And moreover, they are doing so despite the absence of the neocons' would-be warrior queen, Hillary Clinton, who compared Putin to Hitler and made getting tough with Russia the major foreign policy plank of her losing campaign. Moore, who told us back in 1992 that the election of Bill Clinton was the most important in our history and whose sense of self-glorification and all-knowingness mirrors that of the obnoxious Trump, tweeted on February 13th that, quote, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out what was going on. Trump colluding with the Russians to throw the election to him. And he tweeted again to his followers, telling them to demand that Congress take no business up until it appoints a special committee to investigate and impeach Trump. And here is Moyers, together with Michael Winship, a senior writer for Moyers & Company, telling us on the front page of February 15th issue of the Progressive Populist that, quote, we cannot wait for history's judgment. For the sake of democracy, an independent commission or special prosecutor must be appointed to investigate Russian influence. Later in the article, they wrote that, quote, the dark clouds hovering over American politics must be cleared up. Left unresolved, the allegations present a clear and present danger, a ticking time bomb that could explode and bring an end to America's nearly 250-year experiment in self-government, end quote. Moyers and Winship prominently quote a former U.S. diplomat, James Bruno, who in the Washington Monthly reaffirmed the intelligence paper's conclusions at the coals of Russia's intelligence cyber attack were to, quote, undermine faith in the U.S. democratic process, denigrate Secretary Clinton and harm her electability and potential presidency, and that the Russian government had developed a clear preference for President-elect Trump. Read that again slowly and carefully, Moyers and Winship tell us. The intelligence community is saying that a foreign country, Russia, deliberately interfered with and corrupted our electoral process to favor the election of Donald Trump, end quote. Well, it is the intelligence community, my friends, we need to remember, that has repeatedly fabricated lies and told them to the American public and the world, not just to justify our invasion of Iraq, but all of our imperial policies and foreign interventions since the end of World War II. Moreover, as I mentioned on my last program, contrary to the notion that Russia could undermine America's faith in the political process, numerous national polls have revealed this to have been a national problem long before the last year's presidential campaign. And I would think that Moyers himself discussed that subject more than once on his radio program. It was also no secret that Clinton entered the election race with a low rating of any Democratic presidential candidate, and the Russians had nothing to do with that. Of course, Putin would have preferred Trump to Clinton. While Donald was praising Putin as a strong leader, she had compared him, as I mentioned, with Hitler after the annexation of Crimea and was advocating a stronger NATO to confront Russia's non-existent threat to its neighbors and a no-fly zone over Syria, which the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff warned her would risk a confrontation with Russian military aircraft. The only reference in the article to the Democratic National Committee sabotaging Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, which was revealed in the DNC's emails, ignores that cogent fact, and instead Moyers and Winship blame the FBI for dragging its feet and letting the DNC know it was being hacked. Thus, Moyers and Winship effectively whitewashed the DNC's betrayal of a major sector of the party's base, but not a word about that. It is at times like this I recall that Moyers worked for Lyndon Johnson beginning in 1960 and was his loyal press secretary from 1965 to 1967 during LBJ's criminal escalation of the war in Vietnam, and he has yet to say a public word of criticism against his old boss. But as I mentioned earlier, Moyers is not acting alone in calling for a special commission to investigate Russia's alleged interference in our elections, which clearly has been aggravated by now former National Security Advisor General Michael Flynn's admission that he spoke with the Russian ambassador regarding the additional sanctions on Moscow that President Obama had imposed on Russia on the basis of the alleged hacking. Last week, in my email box contained petitions calling for that special commission from Common Dreams, Color of Change, Move On, and Alternet, endorsing one being circulated by the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Well, today there was one from Common Cause. All of them call for the setting up of a special commission along the lines demanded by Moore and Moyers, to which I can only shake my head and ask, what were all these people doing during the 8 years of President Obama's administration, particularly the first 2 years when Democrats also controlled both houses of Congress? Why, we must ask them, did they accept President Obama's declaration that the country needed to overlook the origins of the Iraq War and to, quote, look forward, not backward, words that were echoed by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi? If not, why did they not publicly challenge Obama for effectively having pardoned George W. Bush and his fellow criminals in Washington, those who were responsible for the destruction of Iraq and the loss of hundreds of thousands of Iraqi American lives, which led to the destabilization of the region, the rise of ISIS, and the hundreds of thousands of refugees? Why was there no demand by any of them then for a special commission to investigate the origins of that war and the prosecution of those responsible for producing the false intelligence that justified it? Can any of them today with a straight face tell us that Russia's alleged interference in the U.S. elections or anything that it might have done in relation to U.S. elections, even if true, is more serious than requiring a special investigation than what this country did in and to Iraq? Those who were silent then, who are calling for a special commission now, need to hang their heads in shame. Now, for the remainder of my commentary, and in recognition of the Ukraine coup, I will let others do the talking. In the first of three clips, you're going to hear a brief conversation I played once before, secretly recorded, no doubt by the Russians, and posted on YouTube 2 weeks before Yanukovych's departure. You will hear Deputy U.S. Secretary of State Victoria Nuland, a former top aide Dick Cheney, and Hillary Clinton's former press spokesperson, discussing with U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Jeff Pyatt who they want to head the Ukraine government after Yanukovych's departure. In another clip still available on YouTube, which I also played for you back in 2014, Nuland bragged to a group of Ukrainian-American businessmen that Washington has spent $5 billion to bring about regime change in their homeland and take it from Russia's orbit into the West. In this clip, Nuland and Pyatt banter about which of the Ukrainian opposition figures should go into the government as prime minister. Klitsch, he calls. Klitsch is Vitali Klitschko, a former heavyweight boxing champion and an opposition leader. And Yats is Arseniy Yatsenyuk, Nuland's choice, who ends up getting the job. It was what might be called a milder form of interfering in another country's government's affairs, American style, and here it is.
What do you think?
I think we're in play. The Klitschko piece is obviously the complicated electron here, especially the announcement of him as deputy prime minister. And you've seen some of my notes on the troubles in the marriage right now. So we're trying to get a read really fast on where he is on this stuff. But I think your argument to him, which you'll need to make, I think that's the next phone call we want to set up, is exactly the one you made to Yacht. And I'm glad you sort of put him on the spot on where he fits in this scenario. And I'm very glad he said what he said in response.
Good. So I don't think Cleat should go into the government. I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you think, in terms of him not going into the government, just let him sort of stay out and do his political homework and stuff. I'm just thinking, in terms of sort of the process moving ahead, we want to keep the moderate Democrats together. The problem is going to be Tanibok and his guys. And, you know, I'm sure that's part of what Yanukovych is calculating on all of this.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Cleach and Tanibok on the outside. He needs to be talking to them four times a week. You know, I just think Cleach going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Okay. Good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him as the next step?
My understanding from that call to me was that the big three were going into their own meeting and that Yats was going to offer in that context a three-way, you know, a three-plus-one conversation or three-plus-two with you. Is that not how you understood it?
No, I think, I mean, that's what he proposed, but I think just knowing the dynamic that's been with them where Klitschko has been the top dog, he's going to take a while to show up for whatever meeting they've got. He's probably talking to his guys at this point, so I think you reaching out directly to him helps with the personality management among the three, and it gives you also a chance to move fast on all this stuff and put us behind it before they all sit down and he explains why he doesn't like it.
Okay, good. I'm happy. Why don't you reach out to him and see if he wants to talk before or after?
Okay, will do. Thanks.
Okay, I've now written, one more wrinkle for you, Jeff.
Yeah.
Can't remember if I told you this or if I only told Washington this, that when I talked to Jeff Feltman this morning, he had a new name for the UN guy, Robert Seri. Did I write you that this morning?
Yeah, okay. I saw that.
He's now gotten both Seri and Ban Ki-moon to agree that Seri could come in Monday or Tuesday.
Okay.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it and, you know, the EU.
No, exactly. And I think we've got to do something to make it stick together because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it. And again, the fact that this is out there right now, I'm still trying to figure out in my mind why Yanukovych did that. But in the meantime, there's a Party of Regions faction meeting going on right now, and I'm sure there's a lively argument going on in that group at this point. But anyway, we could land Jolly set up on this one if we move fast. So let me work on Klitschko, and if you can just keep, I think we want to try to get somebody with an international personality to come out here and help to midwife this thing. And then the other issue is some kind of outreach to Yanukovych, but we probably regroup on that tomorrow as we see how things start to fall into place.
So on that piece, Jeff, when I wrote the note, Sullivan's come back to me VFR saying you need Biden, and I said probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So
okay.
Biden's willing.
Okay, great.
All right.
Thanks.
That was Victoria Nuland and Jeff Pyatt. I should mention that just before you hear the word EU, Victoria Nuland used the F word to refer to the European Union, but I deleted that for FCC regulations, but she said that. Okay, now we go to Ukraine to hear from the Senate's leading hawks, Lindsey Graham and John McCain, who at Minnesota's Amy Klobuchar met with Ukrainian troops on December 27th and urged them to go on the offensive against Russia. They are introduced by Ukrainian President Pedro Poroshenko, with Graham speaking first.
Я як президент і як верховний головнокомандувач хочу подякувати кожного з вас.
I admire the fact that you will fight for your homeland.
Я захоплююсь тим, що ви боретеся за свою батьківщину.
Your fight is our fight.
Ваша боротьба – це наша боротьба.
2017 will be the year of offense.
Рік 2017 рік буде роком нападу.
All of us will go back to Washington and we will push the case against Russia.
Ми всі повернемося до Вашингтону і ми будемо відстоювати санкції проти Росії.
Enough of a Russian aggression.
Досить вже російської агресії.
It is time for them to pay a heavier price.
Час вже за щоб вони заплатили важчу ціну.
Our fight is not with the Russian people but with Putin.
Ми боремося не з російським народом, але з Путіним.
Our promise to you is to take your calls to Washington.
Наша обіцянка це те, що ми вашу боротьбу доведемо до Вашингтону.
Inform the American people of your bravery.
Проінформуємо американський народ про вашу відважність.
And make the case against Putin to the world.
І покажемо про докази проти Путіна усьому світу.
I believe you will win. I am convinced you will win, and we will do everything we can to provide you with what you need to win.
Я вірю в те, що ви виграєте, переможете. Я переконаний в тому, що ви переможете, і ми вам допоможемо всіма можливими засобами.
And we have succeeded not because of equipment, but because of your courage.
Ви успішні не через обладнання, але через вашу відважність.
So I thank you, and the world is watching, and the world is watching because we cannot allow Vladimir Putin to succeed here, because if he succeeds here, he will succeed in other countries.
That was John McCain finishing up. The War Hawks from Washington. He's seems to be a bit senile. Well, we're going to conclude with some rare words, sanity, from former congressman and presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich. He was interviewed last week on Fox News after the revelations that Trump's national security advisor, Michael Flynn, had spoken with Russia's ambassador at the time that Obama had imposed new sanctions on the Russians and had lied about it to Vice President Mike Pence. So here we go.
Well, General Flynn has admitted misleading the vice president, but I think we have to look at this a little bit deeper. A phone call from the incoming director of national security was intercepted and the contents given to the media. And you have to so obviously shared by intelligence officials. Now, what's at the core of this? Is an effort by some in the intelligence community to upend any positive relationship between the U.S. and Russia. There's gold in them there, hills. There are people trying to separate the U.S. and Russia so that this military-industrial intel axis can cash in. The American people have to know that there's a game going on inside the intelligence community where there are those who want to separate the U.S. from Russia in a way that would reignite the Cold War. That's what's at the bottom of all this. It's like, wake up, America. What's going on in the intelligence community with this new president is unprecedented. They're making every effort to upend him. Who knows what the truth is anymore? This is like the electronic version of Mad Magazine, spy versus spy. And so the bottom line is, we should not start a Cold War again with Russia. The American people forked over billions of dollars for the last one and changed the quality of life in this country. There's something wrong going on here in the intelligence community. It's not just this administration. I want to remind the viewers and that in the closing months of the Obama administration, they put together a deal with Russia to create peace in Syria. A few days later, a military strike in Syria killed 100 Syrian soldiers, and that ended the agreement. What happened is, inside the intelligence and the Pentagon, there was a deliberate effort to sabotage an agreement the White House made. This is like deep state. This is like some kind of a spy novel. But it's real, and the American people have to understand a game is being played with the security of our country. We need to have closer ties with Russia. We can't be suckers in this, but we cannot also have certain people playing an agenda that separates us from our aspirations for peace between the two major powers in the world. This isn't about whether you're for or against Donald Trump.
Right.
Hello? Mm-hmm. This is about whether or not the American people are bystanders in a power play inside the intelligence community, the outcome of which could determine our relationships with Russia and whether or not billions of dollars are going to be spent in a new Cold War.
And that was Dennis Kucinich with a voice of sanity, which you ironically heard on Fox News. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. The main purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. Our Palestinian voice this week is Amal Bishara, who is an anthropologist, author, and activist. Amal is Associate Professor of Anthropology at Tufts University. She is a frequent visitor to the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem, which is the home of her husband's family. Amal recently wrote an article which was published in the Journal of Ethnographic Theory, where she compared the differences in how the Palestinian population which lives in the occupied West Bank and the Palestinian population which lives in Israel conducted resistance through demonstrations and how those differences reflected the reality of their lives. I sat down with Amal at the Radcliffe Institute, where she is currently a fellow, to discuss her article and the observations she made through her research. So, Amal, you're an anthropologist and an activist. As an anthropologist and academic, you need to apply a kind of objectivity to your research and writing. We see that in your articles and books, the application of the discipline of academia to follow where your research takes you. But you're also an activist, a Palestinian with a sharp sensitivity to justice and the plight of the Palestinian people. And it's interesting to watch you navigate between those two passions in your life. And by the way, I think you do it very well.
It's kind of you.
You're both a student of Palestinian life and a participant in Palestinian life, which is to say a participant in the resistance, which defines much of the nature of Palestinian life. In your latest article in the Journal of Ethnographic Theory, you discuss the different realities of two Palestinian populations, those who live in the occupied West Bank and those Palestinian Arabs who live in and are citizens of Israel. You write about how demonstrations and acts of resistance reflect those two realities. And it's fascinating. I'd like to begin talking about some of the differences between the realities of life in the West Bank and those of Palestinians who live in Israel, and how those realities define their acts of resistance?
Well, so first of all, I would say that, and I think in some ways it's one of the complications of the project that I'm trying to do, which is exactly as you've described it, to look at Palestinian citizens of Israel and Palestinians in the West Bank and what makes it difficult for them to speak to each other and also to speak as a collective. One of the things that makes that project difficult is that, of course, there's a lot of variation within each category, right? You know, among Palestinians in the West Bank and among Palestinians in Israel. So even as I try to talk about sort of what, you know, what it means to live as a Palestinian in those two different contexts, of course, you know, it kind of, you know, you miss some of the variation within those two places. But in general, you know, Palestinian citizens of Israel are citizens, so they vote, and they have some of the privileges that come with having, you know, an Israeli passport in terms of, for example, travel and social services. But also Palestinian citizens of Israel are systematically discriminated against by the Israeli government. So there are more than 50 laws that discriminate against Palestinian citizens of Israel. And they, you know, range from, you know, laws about political participation to social and economic access to, you know, basically every field of life and law that you can think of. Also, Palestinian citizens of Israel are sort of on the peripheries of the Palestinian National Project, right, which is really, you know, centered in the West Bank. So, you know, they're not, when people, you know, for example, abroad think of the Palestinians, they don't think of Palestinian citizens of Israel. They really think generally, I think, either of Palestinian refugees or Palestinians in the occupied territories. So in some senses, Palestinian citizens of Israel are marginalized twice. First, as Palestinians in a state that defines itself as a state for Jews, and second, as Palestinian citizens of Israel in the Palestinian national movement, which does include them and has, you know, there's sort of been efforts to include, of course, all Palestinians everywhere in the liberation movement over the last decades. But nonetheless, Palestinian citizens of Israel remain on the margins of that project. And then you have Palestinians in the West Bank. You have Palestinians of the West Bank who are living, you know, under Palestinian administration through the Palestinian Authority, although differently, whether they're in cities or in villages or, you know, different locations within the West Bank, but they're also living under Israeli military occupation. So that military occupation drastically limits all of their rights, you know, to life, liberty, you know, to the right to gather, the right to move, right to life, you know, arrest raids can happen at any time of the day or night. You know, their ability to move between the West Bank and Israel, their ability sometimes to move from the West Bank to any other place in the world, you know, all elements of their lives are affected by military occupation.
Or even in Jerusalem. That's another whole reality is people in Jerusalem.
Great point.
Is it... is it safe to say, I don't want to push this too far, but is it safe to say that one distinction is that Palestinians living in the West Bank really, really face an occupation. They know what an occupation is. It's a military occupation. Uh-huh. Whereas Palestinians living in Israel face more of a discriminatory or segregated society, that they're fighting inequalities, but not the military in the same way that those in the West Bank face the occupation. Is that?
I would say yes. Yeah. Yes, but, right? So mm-hmm. Palestinian citizens of Israel actually lived under military occupation from 48 to 66.
Right.
So, you know, many people have memories of what it was like to live under military occupation. So, for example, my dad, I was walking with him. He's a Palestinian citizen of Israel. We're walking on the periphery of his village of Tarshiha. Hardly on the periphery, like, mm-hmm. you know, just right on the edge of town, but really within, you know, near the houses and buildings. And I said, so Dad, did you need a movement permit to come here when you were a kid? And he said, when I was a kid, we were allowed to be on this side of the street, but not on that side of the street without a movement permit. So, you know, also Palestinian citizens of Israel have experienced military occupation that is quite similar to the military occupation that we see in the West Bank and Gaza mm-hmm. after 1967. And the other thing I would say is that, so there's that historical parallel. And the other thing is that, of course, the military occupation comes to affect Palestinian citizens of Israel also, right? So, you know, because Palestinians in the occupied territories are defined as the enemy and the outsider, that reflects back onto Palestinian citizens of Israel, and it increases the level of violence that Palestinian citizens of Israel face. So it is, in some ways, you know, legal discrimination against them and, you know, racism against them as sort of an internal minority. But it's also augmented and shaped by the way in which they are associated with an external enemy.
And neither one can go into the other's territory. In other words, a Palestinian Israeli cannot pass into the West Bank. Is that right?
They usually can't go into Palestinian Authority areas of the West Bank that are under Palestinian Authority control. They can't go there legally, but they can go there. It's actually not difficult to go in.
Can they go there easier than a West Bank Palestinian can go into Israel?
Yes, yeah. much easier, much more easily. Yeah.
But what if you have a Jerusalem ID? How does that affect your ability to move?
So if you have a Jerusalem ID, you have an Israeli ID, right, that allows you to move between Israel and the West Bank like an Israeli citizen.
Okay, now...
Can I go back one second? So I wanted to point out that when you're thinking about, you know, the way that the Israeli military occupation affects Israeli laws and society inside, you know, 48 Israel, I think you can make a parallel to the way in which, you know, U.S. occupations abroad and wars abroad have affected domestic politics here. You know, they've increased militarism and racism, right? However, in Israel, that is sort of even more intense because the group of people that's the primary group of people that's discriminated against, and obviously there are others in Israel, is Palestinians, and they are also the same as the external enemy, right? You know, whereas in the United States, you know, you have in Israel also obviously you have migrants from Asia, you have, you know, Jews from a lot of different parts of the Arab world and the world that are discriminated against, and you have, you know, refugees from Africa and so forth, right? So Israel is also very complex, but the primary enemy is Palestinians, and they are the same, you know, as the primary minority inside Israel, right? And so sort of the way in which the external military occupations affect domestic politics and society is that much more intense. And even the word domestic becomes something that's really hard to define, you know?
Yes.
Which is not as true in the United States.
Okay, let's talk about your research. You went and observed demonstrations. You sort of have observed acts of resistance in Israel, in Palestinian areas of Israel, Palestinian demonstrations, and then you've also observed and have a lot of experience with demonstrations and resistance in the West Bank, particularly Bethlehem, and I want to talk about that later. But so you made these observations and you drew some conclusions from that. So I talk about your article because I found it fascinating.
Thank you so much. Well, so it happened that I was in Palestine in 2014 during the Gaza War, and for the months leading up to it. And I had a research project that I was doing that I, you know, really enjoyed and got a lot out of, but this sort of came up on the side because of the war and also because of the major strikes of the hunger strikes of prisoners and stuff. So I was going to a lot of protests in solidarity with prisoners and then against the war in Gaza in both Israel and in the West Bank. And they were mainly Palestinian protests, although I did go to some that you could say were sort of more inside Israel. I went to some protests that were more mixed, Palestinian and Jewish, but most of them were sort of defined as Palestinian-spaced. And that doesn't mean that there weren't Israeli Jews there. It just means that Palestinians were the ones who organized it.
They were defining it.
Yeah. So, you know, the ones inside Israel, you know, were kind of more obviously comfortable for me as a person who grew up in the United States and who is used to American sort of political actions, right? You know, so they were protests where people were walking in the streets or standing in one place, holding signs and doing chants and, you know, maybe wearing, you know, a keffiyeh or wearing other kind of gear that sort of expresses something about your political view. Yeah. So I was pretty comfortable. Although it was also tense at certain times, you know, because there was a massive, you know, there were massive attempts to arrest protesters, particularly at a protest I went to in Haifa and stuff. But it was at least, it was much more recognizable to me as a, you know, a person who lives in the United States. In the West Bank, the protests were about direct confrontation with the Israeli army. And those kinds of protests happened every night during the Gaza war. And I should also say that in the West Bank, they would also have the kinds of protests where people were standing and holding signs or doing other kinds of, you know, activities like that. But the kinds of protests that kind of attracted the most attention and were seen as the hallmark form of protest by Palestinians in the West Bank were these direct confrontations with the military.
So what were some of the differences between the... You went to a protest in Lydda. And describe that. Describe the kind of signs that they had, the kind of protest it was, and how the police responded, and just sort of the general atmosphere of the protest. And then we can talk about when you went back. In fact, you went back that night. And there were some demonstrations in Bethlehem. And anyway, let's talk about the difference between the two and the kind of signs that they had and the responses of the Israeli, whether they were soldiers on one side or police on the other.
Mm-hmm. So at this protest in Lit, there were people gathered in sort of the main square. And the interesting thing about it is that even the place names, the Palestinians who organized these protests used Palestinian place names to define where they're going, even though those place names cannot be found on the map or on street signs anymore, right? Because these names have all been changed to be, you know, Israeli and very, very deeply Zionist place names. So they would gather in the main park and they walk down the main street to another square. And, you know, from the minute we gathered, there was police surveillance of us. However, there was also a counter demonstration a little bit away. So I felt, frankly, that the police were absolutely surveilling us. And I know that some people were called into an investigation with police after, you know, some Palestinian protesters were called in to be investigated after it.
Were there some Israeli, pro-Palestinian Israelis sort of as part of the demonstration?
Yeah, definitely.
And were they investigated then after it?
I think there was only a few leaders who were investigated. It wasn't, or I don't know actually exactly who was investigated, but I know that some people...
But they weren't treated any differently. I mean, they were all part of the whole thing. And then there was a pro-Zionist,
a pro-war protest, yes. Right? And it was very energetic. And I have to say that, like, I felt this moment where I felt that the police were absolutely surveilling us. You know, however, they're also, frankly, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but I felt a sense of protection as well, you know, which is that I would have felt less safe if they weren't there.
Yeah, they didn't want an incident. They clearly...
I knew I was being surveilled, but I also felt that
they were taking pictures and doing everything that they do here. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right.
Now, I mean, I was at other protests where, you know, Palestinians were arrested for protesting, you know, and certainly I've been at protests where there was direct confrontation between protesters and the police, and, you know, they included, you know, police beating protesters and so forth and using tear gas and so forth against protesters inside Israel. But at this particular one, that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Were there protests besides at Lib where you were, were they all through Israel during the... during the bombardment of Gaza, so they were
There were frequent protests, yeah. And I definitely noticed the surveillance at all of them.
And then compare that to the nature of the demonstrations in the West Bank, and particularly Ida Camp, that you know very well. Your husband's family is from Ida Camp. You go there every year with your family. It's your village, to you know, to a large extent. That's where you go. And Ida Camp is a particularly hot spot. It is up against the wall. It is right near Rachel's tomb, which is a sacred site to three religions, but available only to Jews, is my understanding. And there's a military base there, camp encampment there. And so it really is a hot spot. And we just hear day in and day out about what's happening in Ida Camp. The military comes in, the tear gas, the kids throwing stones, the resistance. Talk about the resistance in the Ida Camp.
Well, so let me, and I should have backed up to say one more thing about Idlib, which was that I was amazed and inspired and blown away, really, by what it meant to be a part of that group in that place at that time. You know, people were waving Palestinian flags, and holding signs of, you know, all kinds of signs against the war, but also they were, the chants were really, really powerful. And, you know, there was one chant that, you know, went on for like a very long time, like 5 minutes. It was poetry in the streets, you know, and it was a riff on, a poem that dates back to the 1970s from the Palestinian Liberation Movement. And the way they kind of changed it around made it this poem that kind of called out to all these different Palestinian locations, to Gaza, to Ramle, to Lid, to Mukhayam Balata, to Ain al-Halwa, to Kfar Barah, all these Palestinian place names. And it was inspiring and beautiful because all of a sudden, you know, Lid is not the center of Palestinian life inside Israel. It's certainly not the center of Palestinian life writ large, right? You know, and yet all of a sudden these protesters from this one place are calling out all these place names, kind of evoking Palestine, evoking a Palestinian geography that has never existed concretely on the ground, right? Because they're also calling out to refugee camps in Lebanon and so forth, you know? So they're saying, we're all of these are Palestinian places and all of those people are Palestinians. And it's totally inspiring and moving, right? So that was amazing. And then in the West Bank, you go back and the chants and protests, the chants at the protests kind of take a back seat. they're kind of the prologue, but the real thing that's happening is the direct protest.
It's
with
the confrontation.
Through stones, fireworks, primarily stones and fireworks, and sometimes other means like Molotov cocktails, but people tried not to use those at demonstrations because obviously they would make the rest of the demonstrations so much more dangerous for everybody, and so you know, people would criticize sometimes the use of Molotov cocktails or pipe bombs at these protests because they would make participation way too dangerous. But it was stones and fireworks. And that, of course, is a kind of a bravery that is also inspiring, but in such a different way, right? Because these are people taking risks right then and there for their lives.
Yeah.
And, you know, they know that they can risk imprisonment, long-term imprisonment for these kinds of actions. And so for me, it was jarring and dizzying in some sense to move between these two contexts where such different things were counting as bravery and, you know, sort of two completely different ways to resist, basically. Each really bold,
right? You use
and moving.
Use it in your article. Use the term "the pen and the gun," referring, I guess, to Lid being sort of resistance and the pen and the kind of resistance that they get in the West Bank.
Well, just to be very, the Israeli oppression comes through the pen inside Israel, and the Israeli oppression comes through the gun in the West Bank, although I also try to muddy that up.
But the gun's the other way, I mean.
Of the Israelis, exactly. The Israelis against Palestinians,
But that really is a very nice defining symbolism of the difference of what's going on in these two places.
And of course that line comes directly from, you know, a man I met whose house was under threat of demolition in Qalansawa, which is a village or a town in the Muthallath part of Israel. And he said to me, Palestinians inside Israel, I can't remember the verb, but, you know, we're like, you know, we are kind of killed by the pen, and Palestinians in the West Bank are killed by the gun. Yeah. And, you know, in fact, the pen can be just as difficult.
Oh, yeah, that's the discriminatory laws. That's the... Yeah,
exactly.
That's the way they control.
And that's what I think, in some ways, one of my goals, not my only goal, but one of my goals as an ethnographer is to do that good listening, so that I'm listening to people who, you know, aren't going around giving lectures three times a week as professors of anthropology or anything else. You know, people who are living under, you know, threat every day of losing their lives, you know, their sort of their lifestyle, right? He could be losing his house any time. And yet he's also got a philosophy of politics that, you know, people can benefit from hearing, right? So as an ethnographer, I think that's one of my jobs, not my only job, to make sure that voices like that come to the fore a bit.
Yeah. It was interesting. I was in Lydd at one point, and it's an interesting place because it was, before 48, very much an Arab-Palestinian town, and it's taken over, and the people... who lived in some very beautiful, very nice homes, were driven out, and now the Palestinians really live in a ghetto. I mean, they are segregated. Many cannot live in the homes that they grew up in, even though they're right there. And it's just, it's such a stark symbol of the discrimination and the segregation and the apartheid that takes place when you go to a place like Lydd. Mm-hmm. And we were there at a time when they had some beautiful homes had been built by Palestinians and were set for demolition.
Wow.
And many of the citizens were sitting in a tent. You know, it's just sort of a resistance to this, and it was so stark. I'll never forget being in Lydd. Okay.
The home demolitions that are going on at an increased pace right now are really terrifying, and they're something that have always really shook me because it's such a personal loss, obviously, for a family or for community, and yet it's also a loss for, you know, Palestinians as a collective. So yeah, they're terrible. And I don't know, but I have a feeling, because there was a demolition of a number of homes in Qalansawa very recently, and I expect that the person I spoke to lost his home in that demolition.
And then they can't rebuild. You can't get permits.
Yeah, they can't get permits, right. He was building on his own land. His building is on his own land, but because it was zoned either for agricultural or industrial use, he's not allowed to build a house there. And so even though, you know, it's the only house that his family
again,
has.
That's the story again and again and again. We know the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions for years have been opposing that, and for years and years rebuilding 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times, sometimes
ten,
as we know, some people that they just build it every time it gets knocked down. And the toll that it takes on the family, on kids to see their again. I mean, it's hard to fathom.
Very hard to fathom. I mean, the work of Nadra Shalhoub Kevorkian, she does an incredible job writing about this.
Yeah.
But I think, Al-Araqib, a village in the Negev, in the Naqab, has been destroyed over 100 times, right? And also this year we've seen the destruction of Umm al-Hayran, a village that...
Actually, we've talked about that a few times on This Week in Palestine. Nadia Ben Yosef. And I remember she came back, and I think she was at Tufts or somewhere where we went and recorded her talking about the demolition of the village in the Negev, and the demolitions around the Negev would just go on and on and on with just one after another. It's unbelievable. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about again. Go back to Ida Camp and talk a little bit about the water project there. It's very tied up to what we're doing here, and. I want to talk about the Walk for Water to raise money for it, but I just get an update on it because we've talked about that project a lot on This Week in Palestine, and so just spend a few minutes on that.
Yeah, so The water crisis for Palestinians takes many different forms. So for Palestinians in Gaza, for example, after 10 years of blockade and three major wars, the water is, and increased population density, very poor infrastructure. The aquifer is being polluted by both salt water and by sewage water. So, like, only 10% of Palestinians in Gaza have access to clean drinking water.
Gaza's terrible. Yeah.
Yeah. And then parts of the West Bank, there are people who have much, much, much less availability of drinking water than they should have because Israel, again, controls the amount of water that Palestinians have the access to. And that's definitely the case in Aida refugee camp where, there have been times when Palestinians in Aida refugee camp go, 2 months without having water piped through the networks. So they store water on rooftop tanks. Mm-hmm. And when that water runs out, they have to buy it, which is, very, very expensive for mm-hmm. them. And also the water, storing water in tanks can lead to health problems because the chlorine evaporates and then there's a possibility, of course, of contaminants and, mm-hmm. Bacteria growing there. So it presents a health risk for people.
And most of the water comes from under the West Bank.
Yeah.
So technically it's their water, but
yeah.
It's taken by Israel and then sold back to them, I understand, at four times the price that they sell water to Israelis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. So Israel takes much of the water and gives it to people inside Israel, and then also much of it goes to settlers, and only a small percentage is left for Palestinians, mm-hmm. even though it's from the West Bank aquifer.
Yeah.
So, one of the exciting and inspiring thing that's going on with regards to water and One for Three, which is an organization based here in Boston and working on water and environmental issues in the West Bank and especially in Aida, has been to build a rain collecting cistern. And rain collecting cisterns, of course, are part of Palestinian history. This is how Palestinians
right.
made it through the
it's
summer.
Very ancient, actually.
Yeah.
Way back. I mean, Romans. I mean, you're way, way, way back. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is sort of just making the old new again and collecting water from the rooftop of a community-based organization, which is called Lajet Center, and storing it in a new cistern that is on, I think the construction is complete.
Is it?
I believe it's complete, but if not, it's almost complete. It's definitely under construction.
Great.
And that water will be used to alleviate water shortages for residents and also for the operation of the center itself. And it's also a model so that people can come and see how this kind of cistern can, ease the water shortage.
So that's water for, that's not drinking water.
Actually, apparently they are going to, treat
really?
It. That's what my understanding is, yeah.
Wonderful. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not just gray water then. It's
that's the plan for this cistern, yeah. And it's exciting because, if Israel is controlling the water that's under the ground, what's left? The water that comes from the sky. And, so using that smart, using mm-hmm. that resource well is a really exciting thing. And I think that, for people in Aida, there's been that water and these increased attention to issues around the environment has, One for Three has also been able to build rooftop gardens that allow families to have access to vegetables that they're growing. So they know, for example, that there aren't chemicals on them. And actually, when I talk to people about vegetables in the West Bank, there's a lot of talk about what chemicals are being used on their produce, right? And also about how fresh their produce is. And, for people who love good vegetables, that's a real problem, right? Or who want their children and themselves to be healthy and to know that there are no chemicals on their produce, right? So the fact that people are able to build, to grow so much on their own rooftops is a really exciting thing.
Was there any trouble with permits to build the cistern? Was that ever an issue?
The permit would not be obtained from the Israelis because it is in Area A.
Ah, I see.
Yeah.
I see. Big difference.
Yeah, right. Very big difference.
Because
yeah.
that's exactly the kind of thing that when they have control, they will not allow this. And,
I just saw a map of the wells and cisterns that have been destroyed by Israel in recent years, but I don't have the statistics on the top of my head, but it would be good to check it out.
No, because controlling the population, which is what they're all about, mm-hmm. Is often done by shooting the water tanks, mm-hmm. you know, making life so miserable, and shooting, so they lose the water in the tanks. And so that's a real weapon for Israel. That's a weapon that they use.
And for me, sort of the collaboration between 143 and Lajit, which is the community-based organization in Idai refugee camp, that collaboration is about water and is kind of providing that concrete value of access to water and then rooftop gardens. But it's also about kind of a broader statement, which is that we can help remake our space into a healthier place for all of us, right? You know, we have the resources. We can do this together. You know what I mean? Right, because Israel is trying to take away, you know, limit access to water and also just limit access to a healthy environment in a million different ways, as we know, right? And this is to say we can take the small step together to rebuild our environment so that we can thrive in it as well as we can under the circumstances. So that's what, to me, it's like a mixture of something that is sort of a humanitarian thing, but it also is connected to a political statement about how we can retake power in our own communities.
Yeah.
And I have to say that that's what's exciting to me about the Walk for Water, too, is that it is about a humanitarian impulse of raising money for those projects, but it's also about creating a space for people to walk together to support a healthy environment there and here and access to water there. And Palestinian rights right here in our own city,
right?
And to do that together, and we all know the power of protest, and we're seeing that more and more, right? So it's
we have the work of the Water Alliance, which is a whole group, and working together around the issue of water is so important because the education value is enormously important, I think.
I have learned a lot as a scholar because the heart of my work is not about water. The heart of my work is not about water. But so I've learned a lot from the activists here about water that I take back to my scholarship. So I think that it's incredible cross-fertilization that I'm so grateful for. Mm-hmm. And I've been especially grateful for, since the elections and during the elections, you know, to know that we have built a great community that supports Palestinian rights and the rights of refugees and immigrants and people of color. Has been a great gift to me in the last months.
So the Walk for Water is April 22nd, mm-hmm. which is a Saturday, going to be on a Saturday morning. We're looking for people to walk. We're looking for people to volunteer.
And raise money.
As walkers. And they can get information about that at 143.org.
Yeah.
1-4-3. Mm-hmm.
.org. Yeah.
And there's a way to sign up and learn about it
and learn more about these projects.
And more.
Yeah. It should be a really great day.
Yeah. It should be. Well, Amal, thank you for the time that you've taken to talk with us on This Week in Palestine.
Thank you for all that you do.
We try.
You're incredible, John, for this energy.
And hope you keep up your good work in academia. And I know you'll keep up your good work as an activist.
Thank you. It's very kind.
That we know. That's a given.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
That was a conversation with Tufts Professor Amal Bishara, recorded at the Radcliffe Institute, where she is currently a fellow. We end this morning with some excerpts from Amal Bishara's article, her conclusion, which summarizes the findings of her research. Amal concludes, and I quote, "Palestinians in Israel and the West Bank resist Israeli rule with different approaches, even as they draw on a shared heritage of resistance. In Israel, the primary forms of public opposition to the 2014 Gaza War were vigils and processions, with a few demonstrations involving confrontation with Israeli police. In contrast, while people in the West Bank held vigils, they poured most of their energy into direct confrontation with the Israeli army. When one larger protest in Nazareth, inside Israel, erupted into stone throwing, I heard different explanations among Palestinians in the West Bank than among Palestinian citizens of Israel. The former praised the step. The latter said that it had been Israeli undercover officers who instigated the violence to make the protest more dangerous. However, on other occasions, Palestinian citizens of Israel argued that Palestinians there should also open lines of direct confrontation, and that when they did, this would be even more effective than similar protests in the West Bank. As one activist inside Israel explained, "We just do not have the culture of resistance to make this happen now." Palestinians' inability to express themselves collectively across these two communities is partially due to Israel's closure policies, which limit actual co-presence. But it is also due to Israel's different communicative restrictions on these communities, which yield distinct approaches. What looks like a successful protest in each place is quite disparate. Fragmentation in geography and political culture is a key factor producing Palestinian subalternities, compounding the obstacles to expression that come from either being a minority excluded from the national project, as are Palestinian citizens of Israel, or being subjects of military occupation, as are Palestinians in the West Bank. The more general point, then, is that state-produced divisions between related polities affect conditions for group expression. It is not only that states set limits for political expression in a variety of ways, it is also that naturalized sense of separation between people into different polities, in this case, Israel and the West Bank, acts as another limit on expression. The differences between two Israeli modes of repression multiply their effectiveness. This is one key dimension by which the state produces publics, counterpublics, and their norms. It may at first seem as though these two Palestinian groups have different goals. Palestinian citizens of Israel seem to be seeking to articulate a shared identity as Palestinians, while Palestinians under occupation, their national identity firmly established, seem to be struggling for territory. It may seem that chanting and stone throwing are quite different forms of resistance. However, both saw protesting for Palestinians in Gaza during the war to be of crucial importance, worth significant risks. Though they never protested together, when they did chant, they used similar words. Each of these protests constituted a collective subject serially and intertextually with other protests that year and across the decades of Palestinian resistance. The forms their resistance took differed somewhat, but each form of resistance was a means through which Palestinians worked through the ideas about Palestinian collectivity and Israeli violence. The predominantly linguistic and the predominantly bodily or protests dominated by embodied talk and those dominated by physical action are intimately related. They are ways to explore the same themes. They are by no means polar opposites. Indeed, we need to insist on recognizing the embodied in speech and in the semantic in action, and the ways they blend, augment, or contradict each other in single performances. When we look at speech as embodied and emplaced and recognize the performative in a wide variety of protests, the relationships our practices of resistance can become clearer. So concludes Professor Amal Bishara. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org or listen to us at any time via the archive found on the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive, go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on that archive for 2 weeks. To reach our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
The people that run our society feel the same way about us, the citizens of the United States, that they feel about the citizens of South Vietnam. And they may tell you that you're special because you're an American, but you're not.
Take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp, foggy,
you're listening to episode 746 of Unwelcome Guests, The Tyranny of Enemy Images, Part 1. I'm Robin Upton. And that short quote we heard was author and researcher Douglas Ballantyne with, I think, one of the least contentious beginnings we've ever had to the show. Its importance, I think, will become relevant to you as we hear the next hour
in which Douglas Valentine explains about the Phoenix Program, a systematic and psychopathic effort to undermine social cohesion because South Vietnam happened to be populated by people who didn't approve of the US by and large. They thought, right, well, we need a scorched earth policy here, and if we need to destroy this society to save it, then so be it. As we shall hear, although they were ultimately unsuccessful in that operation, that hasn't stopped them from using what they learnt in the Phoenix program as a basis for similar operations ongoing worldwide. Many thanks to Bonnie Faulkner, whose excellent Guns and Butter provided the raw material. This interview and another one next week, which stirred me out of sloth and got an episode together. I've slightly cut hesitations, but I shall link to the original audio. This is from Guns and Butter, episode 358. Many thanks again to Bonnie Faulkner. If you'd like to hear more of the same, you can go to her website, gunsandbutter.org.
They have now refined these systems and the way to organize and manage them so that the Phoenix model can be perfectly applied anywhere around the world. And the CIA, it actually has created 10, 15, 20 of these Phoenix-style centers around the world and is now organizing itself in this manner so it can more perfectly coordinate with military forces and the State Department in countries where it's fighting this war on terror.
Douglas Valentine is the author of several works of historical nonfiction, including The Phoenix Program, about the CIA in Vietnam, and The Strength of the Wolf and The Strength of the Pack, which discuss the history of federal drug law enforcement. He also edited a poetry anthology with Our Eyes Wide Open, Poems of the New American Century. His latest book is The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. Today we discuss the Phoenix Program in Vietnam, how systems analysis was used to implement the program, and how the Phoenix model is still in use today. Your book, The Phoenix Program, America's Use of Terror in Vietnam, was originally published in 1990, but trashed by a review in the New York Times by Morley Safer, who'd been a reporter in Vietnam. You have written that the book was killed because it said that Phoenix never would have succeeded if the reporters in Vietnam hadn't covered for the CIA. Your book, The Phoenix Program, America's Use of Terror in Vietnam, has now been published online by the Forbidden Bookshelf series. With regard to the war in Vietnam in general, your book paints a very complex picture of the bureaucratic structures of both the civilian and military components and their interfaces with each other. A constantly shifting chain of command, personnel, programs, strategies, tactics. It was impossible for me to track it all. The whole enterprise reads like a god-awful mess, even apart from the incredible violence and carnage of that war, and the Phoenix program in particular. In your book, you mention organizational reforms that paved the way for Phoenix. What were you referring to?
It helps to have a little history. So, you know, to put it in context, like you said, it's a very big subject. And just let me lead up to how it all came to be. It'll only take a minute or two. But as your listeners may know, the United States first intervened in Vietnam in around 1954, 1955, when the country was divided in half. And the great powers of the world were going around dividing up countries all over the world at the time. Korea got divided up. A lot of countries got divided up. And the North went to what were called the communists under Ho Chi Minh, and the South went to the United States, which installed a puppet president named Diem. Diem was a Catholic, and he did not have widespread support Vietnam was 95% Buddhist. So by 1963, it was evident that the Americans could not gain any political, real political support in South Vietnam with Diem as president. So the CIA bumped him off in 1963. They allowed a cabal of South Vietnamese generals to knock off Diem. And they put in a cabal of Buddhist generals, and they thought this would help gain support of the rural population for the American presence in South Vietnam. And they began really waging a counterinsurgency against the rural population. It was very intense. And the CIA was leading that effort to pacify the South Vietnamese population and make them support the South Vietnamese government, which did not represent any of their interests. But that was the struggle that the CIA was facing at the time. And they put a lot of programs in place, which were called pacification programs. They set up a secret interrogation center in each of South Vietnam's 44 provinces. And they created what were called counter-terror teams in every province, which would go off and hunt the supporters of the Viet Cong. And they set up what were called armed propaganda teams, which would go into the villages and try to propagandize people. And they also set up in 1964 a lot of sort of Stalinist tribunals. Some of them were military and some of them were civilian, in which anybody who didn't actively support the South Vietnamese government could be tried on national security charges without any evidence and sent to jail, sent to prison. So they put all these programs, the CIA put all these programs in place. And in 1965, the United States government sent the military in because the war still wasn't going very well. And when the United States military arrived, it was, you know, hundreds of thousands of soldiers were fighting. North Vietnamese troops had now started to infiltrate along the Ho Chi Minh trails, coming into mostly the northern and central parts of South Vietnam. But by 1966, the United States realized it still did not have the support of the South Vietnamese citizenry, which was overwhelmingly supporting what was called the National Liberation Front. The Americans had the support of, you know, the bourgeoisie, which was in the cities, but out in the countryside, they did not have the support of the people. So in late 1966, the White House told the CIA to create what was called a General Staff for Pacification. And they did this secretly. And by the summer of 1967, the CIA had created this General Staff for Pacification, which combined all of the CIA programs that it was conducting in the countryside and in the cities with all the U.S. military programs and all the State Department programs, all the South Vietnamese programs, which were involved in pacification. And that was called the Phoenix Program. The Phoenix Program was based on what you referred to earlier, systems theory, systems analysis. The idea was to coordinate all these many systems which were in place in South Vietnam and which were designed to pacify the South Vietnamese population. And they did this secretly, and they created this secret organization called Phoenix, which had, apart from its mission of coordinating some 25 or 30 different ongoing programs in South Vietnam, but it had the overall purpose of pacifying the South Vietnamese civilians. And that pacifying them meant either coercing or enticing them to support the government. And if they didn't support, off to jail they went, and no trial necessary. And the other part of Phoenix was what was called an attack on the Viet Cong infrastructure. This was the part of the Phoenix that's most known to people, the assassination squads, the torture centers. Through a nationwide network of informants, the CIA ran what was called the Hamlin Informant Program, in which the police established informants in every village, in every district, in every province in South Vietnam that they could. And those informants would inform on any civilian who was in any way sympathetic to the National Liberation Front. Those names, people would be brought into the interrogation centers. They'd be worked over. They'd be made to inform. They'd be made to turn into double agents. And if they didn't, off to the security court they went, or they took them out back and shot them. And once they had the names of the people, and these are civilians, the civilian members who are secretly supporting the National Liberation Front. These are not soldiers. This is a woman who works in the Women's Liberation Unit, or somebody who's a courier, or somebody who's currying rice to Viet Cong guerrilla units. It was all civilians. Once they had identified these people, they would send out the CIA's hit teams, which were called counterterror teams. And the military lent support. The military provided most of the people that worked for the Phoenix program. It was always under CIA direction. And in the early years, it was largely staffed in the provinces by the CIA, but it was always under CIA direction. But once the majority of the people that worked for the Phoenix program were military people who were detailed to the CIA, and there was hundreds and thousands of these people, plus there were thousands and thousands of South Vietnamese secret policemen. There were thousands of these armed propaganda teams, of hit teams. It was just a massive, massive undertaking. It was secret for the first 2 years, but it all relied on very sophisticated theories of, it was computerized, of highly sophisticated theories of organization and management, which is why when the person who was detailed to create the Phoenix program was a guy I interviewed at length. His name was Nelson Brickham. He was a graduate from Yale. He was considered an organizational genius. And he described at length to me, and it's in the book, how he actually used models from Ford Motor Company and businesses, big corporations, in order to streamline and bureaucratize, which was essentially a system of political repression in South Vietnam. If you don't do what we want, either you get killed or you go to jail. And that's one of the best explanations I can give you about the Phoenix program. Of course, it's much more. It relies very much on corruption, on giving the South Vietnamese policemen an incentive to coerce and to bribe and extort South Vietnamese citizens. And it was done on a massive scale. The whole idea was to give the policemen and the people who were collaborating with the United States a free hand to make money off this program. Otherwise, they wouldn't have done it. Just like CIA allowed its generals and its politicians to import and sell heroin and other drugs in South Vietnam, they incentivized this program. They gave the police and the military a free hand to extort the people and just totally fractures the society as a way of being able to either intimidate or coerce or entice somebody into working for the South Vietnamese government. And, of course, it didn't work. The people resisted in very heroic ways. There's a lot of revisionist history about the Vietnam War now, and Phoenix is being touted as something that was actually very successful because it knocked off so many people. The program is estimated between 1967 and 1971 to have killed through the Phoenix assassination team some 30,000 people. The South Vietnamese put the figure at 40,000. my own estimate is that those are way off, and that, and hundreds of thousands of people were killed. Hundreds of thousands of people were sent to prison through these Stalinist tribunals, which relied totally for evidence on the testimony of an anonymous informant who would just say, you know, well, that guy over there stole something from me, so now I'm going to inform, you know, or his dog pooped on my lawn, so now I'm going to say he's a sympathizer for the Viet Cong, and then off to jail the guy would go. He wouldn't even be able to appear in court to defend himself. It was that horrible of a situation. And nevertheless, a lot of revisionist historians now are sort of overlooking those details and saying it was a very successful program. And it has indeed served as the model nowadays for the war on terror and as a model for the Department of Homeland Security in terms of systems theory.
Was the Phoenix program in effect all through the war up until the end of the Vietnam War, or did they ever end it?
No, it went through a couple of different manifestations, but it never ended. I have seen telegrams in a Freedom of Information Act request as late as 1975 talking about how, you know, the Phoenix program was still in effect. There was a negotiated ceasefire. This is at the end of 1972. And the villages that were actually supporting the National Liberation Front would actually start waving, their flag. And according to CIA officers I talked to, this just made it easier now for them to send their Phoenix teams out there and knock these people off, because now they were no longer secret. They were just advertising themselves. And that's one of the reasons that the ceasefire failed, just like all these ceasefires that the United States is negotiating in Syria or wherever always seem to fail, because like all the treaties that negotiates, it never abides by them. And the greatest method for not abiding by any of these treaties is that the CIA is always behind the scenes operating in secret and trying to undermine them. And all the press corps, whether it's in Syria now, Iraq now, Afghanistan now, or back in South Vietnam during the war, all the national security correspondents, the press corps, know exactly what's going on, but they have a deal with the CIA. If they want to keep having access to the plans and strategies and programs that the CIA is clandestinely operating in a country, they have to keep their mouths shut. And if some national security correspondent gets moralistic about it, well, his editor and his publisher will fire him, send him off to Siberia. So it really is no distinction between the press and the CIA. These are the same people, the same class of people. And they have the same exact interests, and they have the same exact filters for making sure that nobody who is ideologically can't be assimilated is dispensed with and never gets into that club. And again, these things have been solidified in America through the kind of organizational geniuses and management structures that were used to create the Phoenix program. These people are adept at creating the social structures and the political structures that keep us repressed. And they do the same thing in the United States that they do overseas. And I had the added advantage of being able to talk to close to 100 CIA officers who were involved in the Phoenix program. And they thought that William Colby, who was at one time the director of Central Intelligence and was the CIA officer most associated with the Phoenix program, he had actually liked my idea for a book, and it helped me, and it introduced me to a lot of these CIA officers, and they spoke openly to me. So even though it's a difficult subject to understand, and even though talking about systems management assumes that you have a capacity to understand how a lot of different systems are being juxtaposed, and that's difficult, and it's off-putting to a lot of people. But if you really want to understand how it goes, you have to spend the time trying to learn about it. You can't understand the petrochemical industry in a day. You know, I mean, these things take a lot of serious study, and the Phoenix program was written with that in mind. That book that came out in 19 was that it would be a serious study that people would have to really spend a lot of time looking at in order to understand the complexities of political repression and social repression. It's not something that you can just say, well, Donald Trump's a billionaire and of course he's going to do it. You really got to understand the intricacies of it if you want to unravel it.
I can certainly appreciate the complexity of it after looking at your book on the Phoenix program. You have mentioned that the Phoenix program was run by the CIA, and the CIA is considered a civilian organization rather than a military one. And you've already pointed out that of course, they worked together to implement the Phoenix program in Vietnam. That's a very complex interaction. With regard to the war on terror, homeland security, but specifically the Phoenix program in Vietnam, how would you analyze who had the upper hand? In your book, you've pointed out that the most important thing about counterterror was collecting intelligence, that was the most important thing. So did that make CIA structure really more important than the military?
Yeah, in a word, because each of these two organizations, you know, the Pentagon and the Department of Defense on the one hand, has a mandate, a congressional mandate. The military even has its own judicial system. It's a huge, immense society that exists somewhat apart, but parallel to civilian American society. And historically, the military at the highest levels is commanded by civilians. The president is a civilian, and he is the commander in chief. And historically, with the United States, it's thought that in order to preserve democratic institutions, civilians have to manage the military. And so there's this presumption in a country like South Vietnam that the U.S. Embassy will be aware of everything that the military is doing. And the ambassador in any country will exercise control over the military. The military can't decide on its own to go into Hemlan provinces in Afghanistan and start blowing up villages. They have to get their okay from the embassy and also from the National Security Council in the White House, which is another civilian organization reporting directly to the president. Well, the CIA is a civilian organization, even though it has a special activities division, which is paramilitary in nature. Its paramilitary force operates clandestinely, covertly, and you never hear about it. You'll not hear about the CIA and paramilitary forces that are operating around the world. And that's because the CIA paramilitary forces are targeted against civilians. As soon as you start fighting soldiers in another country, then the military comes in. And their mandate is to fight the military forces in another country. But the CIA fights guerrillas. It fights militias like you'll find in Iraq. It'll fight an organization that's said to be a non-state actor like ISIS. It has a very specific mandate to wage these kind of secret wars that are political in nature and aimed at civilians, not military forces. The other thing that the CIA does, which is, you know, part of this complex interaction with the military, it covertly begins experimental programs like the Phoenix program that the military will take over once that program, which has been developed clandestinely, covertly, is ready to go public. And you don't hear, again, you won't hear about that in the press because it's considered a national security secret that the CIA will be organizing paramilitary forces or militias in a foreign country, hiring civilians from that country to work, not for their own government, but for the United States government, either to act as counterinsurgents or, as in Syria, to act as insurgents trying to overthrow another government. The CIA is absolutely and totally responsible to do those things. If it rises to the point where a war begins, then the military comes in and takes over. So there's actually congressional mandates which absolutely define where the CIA can go. And there are congressional mandates that define where the military can go. And there's attorneys in the State Department making sure that both these organizations play by the rules. So we may not know the details, but it's all very carefully managed so that nobody is really stepping on anybody's toes. Plus which, a program like Phoenix was instituted to more perfectly coordinate CIA and military operations. That's the beauty of it for the top managers in the National Security Council or anywhere in the civilian government in the United States. They have now refined these systems and the way to organize and manage them so that the Phoenix model can be perfectly applied anywhere around the world. And the CIA in 2015 actually reorganized itself. You can read about it in the New York Times, apart from creating a new digital innovations division to handle all its keystroking and hacking of foreign governments and our own and friendly governments. It actually has created 10, 15, 20 of these Phoenix-style centers around the world and is now organizing itself in this manner so it can more perfectly coordinate with military forces and the State Department in countries where it's fighting this war on terror.
How large of a bureaucracy would you say that the CIA is? This sounds like it's gigantic.
I think it has a budget that's, you know, it's always hard to find out what the CIA budget is because it hides a lot of its budget in the military or organizations that are covering for it. Even like the DEA provides cover for CIA agents. You don't walk around when you're in the CIA with a little badge that says, "Hi, I'm in the CIA." Every CIA officer that's overseas has a cover. CIA, as part of its congressional mandate, can say to the State Department, "We want 100 of your positions this year." If you can say to the military, "We want 1,000 of your positions this year to cover our officers." So a lot of that money that's paying for CIA officers never gets acknowledged in any budget because it's all undercover. And if you were to say, well, the military is covering, you know, $5 billion for the CIA this year, well, then it wouldn't be the CIA anymore. So, but just what's up front is like $35 or $50 billion a year. Of course, the military is $750 billion a year, but it's rapidly approaching a trillion. So the military is much bigger and it's a much bigger organization. But in terms of affecting policy and in terms of having a political impact in the foreign countries that the United States would like to occupy militarily or overthrow, the CIA has a much wider intelligence network. There was recently an article that just talked about, even though all the attention goes to the new Joint Special Operations Command and the special forces in the military, that the CIA is really the force behind all these special forces programs. It's paving the way for them. The Joint Special Operations Command never goes into a country and starts operating there until the CIA has set the scene for them politically and corrupted the politicians in a particular country and made sure that they're going to allow the military to start sending special forces into a country. And the fact of the matter is that many of the highest ranking members of the military's Joint Special Operations Command are actually CIA officers operating under cover because, and it was the same back in Vietnam, you can't have the military going into a foreign country and wreaking political havoc. Everything has to be coordinated at a very high political level, which means liaison. The CIA has liaison with police officials, with government officials, with civilian officials, civilian businessmen, landowners, all sorts of people in foreign countries that are covert. And that's where the bread and butter is having this political support that allows the military to go in. Unless you understand that, you can't understand the distinction between the military and the CIA. And I can tell you right now, the American press corps is not going to tell you. They're not going to explain all this in the kind of detail that you need to know to understand not only the relationship between the CIA and its organization and operations overseas, but how it also it impacts things that happen here in the United States domestically.
With regard to the Phoenix program in Vietnam specifically, you had extensive talks with this guy, Mr. Brickham, and he divided the operations, according to your book, of Phoenix into three categories. The Hamlet Informant Program, which concerned low-level informants in the villages and hamlets. The Province Interrogation Center Program and captured documents. And Agent Penetrations, that is recruitment in place of Viet Cong. I was thinking maybe you could talk about these three different operations and then ultimately about how some of these terror attacks that were instigated, that the people carrying them out would dress as if they were Viet Cong. They were like false flag operations all over the place, where these people that would stage attacks, violent attacks on the Vietnamese infrastructure, which is actually the... just the people, they would be led to believe that these terror attacks were being carried out by the Viet Cong, when in fact they were being carried out by the South Vietnamese or the CIA or the U.S. military, right?
Absolutely. Nelson Brickham was magna cum laude grad of Yale University who went into the CIA in 1949. He was a World War II veteran. Most of the CIA officers that I talked with were World War II veterans. They were older men. Most of them were retired. And because Comey, who, of course, was also a World War II veteran, he had parachuted into France with the OSS and organized resistance to Germany and the Germans. They were older generation, and they looked upon me. My father was a World War II generation guy. He was a veteran, World War II veteran. Because Colby had sent me to them, they looked at me paternalistically, and they liked me, which is one of the reasons the CIA got so mad at me, because guys like Brickham actually thought that I was sent by Colby to get the absolute truth about the Phoenix program. And so they spilled the beans. They told me things that you'll never hear a CIA officer talk about, things that you're not going to read about in a book written by some war correspondent who works for the New York Times or the Washington Post or the LA Times or CBS. You know, they don't get anecdotal. They don't talk about at length. You're not going to read lengthy interviews with anybody from the CIA, but I got that access. And this guy Brickham talked for hours and days. I probably spent a week with him. All my interviews with him are on the internet. They're online. Anybody who wants to listen to the interviews can go to them. I recorded them, so it's there. And that's one of the reasons that the CIA hated me so much. They started spying on me when I was doing this book. They actually, you know, kept a file on me, which I got years later. But Brickham gave me the PhD level lesson in CIA operations. And that's all in the book. He talked not only about the Hamlet Informant Program, the interrogation centers, and the value of agent penetrations. He talked about it in detail. He named the CIA officers who were involved in these programs. He told me about the conflicts and the competitions that CIA officers had amongst themselves and how these things affected operations. For example, Brickham was in the foreign intelligence staff. And within the CIA, the foreign intelligence staff works in liaison with secret policemen in foreign countries his Brigham's, you know, sort of main competitor was a guy named Donahue who ran the CIA's covert action program. Brigham described that as an intelligence gathering operation that works undercover. The covert action people created the hit teams, the counterterror teams. They created the armed propaganda teams. They created something that was called census grievance, in which the CIA teams would go into a village. Apart from the Hamlet informant program, with a little shack, a portable shack, and people could go in and talk to somebody from the South Vietnamese government about their grievances, you know, and supposedly they could do it without the police knowing about it. So there were all these different programs that were ongoing and were conflicting with them, and Brigham tried to bring them all to coordinate all of these even competitive CIA programs through the Phoenix program. All of a sudden now, the covert action people, that staff, would be working with the foreign intelligence staff. Brigham talked primarily about his programs as a foreign intelligence officer, which are the three programs you just mentioned, the Hamlet informant program, the interrogation center program, and agent penetrations. Through their liaison with the South Vietnamese police, Brigham and his foreign intelligence staff tried to recruit agents in every informants in every village in South Vietnam. It was a massive program totally funded by the CIA. The South Vietnamese police had no money. All the money came from the CIA. Brigham said it cost about $1 million a year for all his foreign intelligence programs in South Vietnam. Of course, there were these incentives so the police could make some money on the side, which I was talking about earlier. The covert action programs, the guy who ran them, Donahue, whose interviews are also online, told me that was about $25 million budget. So I even knew how much money they were ostensibly claiming. And Brigham said about the Hamlet informant program, the whole counterinsurgency depended on informants. I said, without informants, you're dead. With informants, you can do anything. So they poured a lot of money and a lot of intention into getting informants, just the way, I should add, the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI and police departments around the country in the United States today are actively going out and trying to get informants to, you know, through all sorts of different programs that Department of Homeland Security is creating here in the United States. Same thing. Law enforcement can do anything if it has informants. It can't do much if it doesn't. So, you know, it's important to understand that system is applied here as well. The big deal were the interrogation centers and the agent penetrations as well. Brigham introduced me to the CIA officer who ran the interrogation center program in South Vietnam, a guy named John Muldoon, who I spent a couple of days with. I met him at his brother's polo farm. His brother was a fabulously wealthy attorney in Washington who owned polo farm, huge, you know, I mean, with the white fences for miles, you know, and the horses prancing around and all that stuff, and guys with funny hats swinging sticks. Muldoon ran the interrogation center program. I spent 2 days with him, and he outlined to me the whole interrogation center program. The whole idea was to build an interrogation center in each province in South Vietnam, which was run by the special branch of the South Vietnamese police. A CIA foreign intelligence officer in each province was in a liaison relationship. He was an advisor to the top South Vietnamese special branch officer in the province. And together, they would work on identifying members of the National Liberation Front. Informants would, you know, say, well, Vin, you know, over in that village, he is the party's district leader. And so the CIA would send a hit team from the covert action program to grab this guy, and they bring him to the interrogation center. The CIA started building these interrogation centers in early 1965. The company they hired to actually oversee the construction was an American corporation called Pacific Architects and Engineers. They had a blueprint. The CIA would buy property on the outskirts of the capital in the province, you know, buy 10, 20, 30 acres, clear it off. Pacific architects and engineers would hire a local South Vietnamese contractor, and they would go in, they would build an interrogation center. I describe them in the book and at length with this interview with Muldoon. And they would then give free of charge this interrogation center to the South Vietnamese police special branch. And they would, the CIA would train the South Vietnamese police special branch officers who worked in it. They would train them how to interrogate people. There was usually about 75 cells. So I outlined the whole detail of them. They're pretty much the model for all the black sites. These Phoenix interrogation centers, they almost look exactly, if you've ever seen a picture of like the black sites that the CIA has in Poland or Thailand or wherever, they basically use the same model. And the CIA, so they built an interrogation center in every province and hired the special branch people to run them, paid all their salaries, and they bugged them so that they wiretapped them, and they bugged the phones. The CIA would, you know, wiretap the phones so that anything that the special branch people were saying, they would hear that too. And all the reports that came out of these interrogation centers were sent to CIA headquarters in Saigon. And if they got a clue about somebody who was very important in the National Liberation Front, rather than going after that person, they would begin an agent penetration operation, which is, according to Brigham, the most important thing that the CIA does. So now you get into real espionage intelligence operations when you start talking about agent penetrations. You know, you've got a guy in the interrogation center, and he says, you know, leave me alone, don't kill my family, and I'll tell you who the district party chief is, the member of the National Liberation Front, who's a member of the Communist Party, the Lao Dong Party. I'll give you his name. And at that point, and I describe the process in detail in my new book, The CIA is Organized Crime, how the recruitment process, I didn't have time to do it in the Phoenix program book, but I do it in this new book. They begin an agent penetration operation, which are very complex. It's the nuts and bolts of what the CIA does in liaison with the special police in a foreign nation. It's the big thing that they do everywhere. They try to get, as an agent, somebody who's in the in South Vietnam, they tried to get people working for who are actually in the National Liberation Front. And if they could get them in, a guy working for them or a woman working for them, they would leave them in place for 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years if they could. And they would protect these people. And these people would report back to the CIA and the special branch of the South Vietnamese police the plans and intentions and strategies. So all throughout South Vietnam, at the same time that the Phoenix program was trying to pacify through violence, intense violence and coercion, of the threat of going to these courts where simply being informed upon that you were going to go to prison without, because you had no defense. At the same time, they were pacifying the lower level, the rural population. They were working to preserve the higher levels of the National Liberation Front. They were actually protecting it throughout the whole country. Part of it had to do with the fact that if the CIA and the South Vietnamese Special Branch started bumping off the senior level people of the National Liberation Front, well, they would go start bumping off all the senior level people of the South Vietnamese Special Branch. They all knew each other. They were related to each other. I had one CIA guy tell me this story. His name was Ed Brady. My interviews with him are available on the internet as well at a place called Cryptocom. They're all there. And Brady was working for the Phoenix Directorate. And he was working in liaison with a very senior South Vietnamese special branch officer. And they were going around and they were inspecting Phoenix program operations around South Vietnam. They, you know, just like management does, you know, you got to go look at the factory here or the warehouse there, you know, and make sure everybody's doing what they're supposed to do. And Brady was working in Saigon at a very high level for the CIA. And he was working with a very high-level special branch guy. And they went to a city called Da Lat, which is in central Vietnam. And they're sitting in a little cafe. And the South Vietnamese guy says to Brady, "That's the province chief's wife." He said, "That's the South Vietnamese wife, and she's going around getting the monthly payoffs here in this restaurant from people from this diner." And Brady said, "Well, why doesn't she have one of her subordinates doing it?" And he said, "Well, it's not the South Vietnamese province chief. That's the National Liberation Front province chief. But I know her, and I know her husband. I mean, we all know each other." And Brady said, "Well, let's grab her. Let's set up an operation. Let's so we can ambush and capture her husband." And the South Vietnamese guy looked at him and he said, "Well, Ed, you're going to be gone in 6 months or maybe a year, but I got to live here, man. And if I start laying a trap for his wife and I start using his children as bait, what do you think they're going to do to me?" And so there was at the very highest levels of this intelligence war, there was what was called a modus vivendi. An accommodation had been reached. And the people who suffered, as in any country, were the poor people. And they're the ones that got smeared and creamed and stomped upon. And there was no protection for them. But through these agent penetration operations, there was another, that's where the modus vivendi was carried out. So they're so sophisticated. The things that are going on are so detailed and so vast that you have to understand that this is the way the CIA operates in every country around the world. It's doing the same thing in Great Britain. It's doing the same thing in France. It's doing this in Ukraine. It took the CIA 20 years to get enough agents and enough Asian penetrations and to corrupt enough secret policemen in Ukraine so that they could pull off the coup there that they pulled off a couple of years ago. That's something that the CIA does. That's not something that the military does. And the formation of paramilitary forces in Ukraine, that's something that the CIA does. It may have a military guy who's detailed to them, and leaves the military special forces and goes to work for the CIA. He's not actually a CIA employee, with life insurance and retirement fund and all that stuff. He's just detailed. The CIA will have a lot of those military people come in and help them to organize militias and flesh out these operations. And they work very closely with military intelligence doing these sorts of things. But that's what the CIA does. And even in a country we're at war with or occupying militarily, like Iraq or Afghanistan, the CIA is handling these political and police operations apart from the military. And as Nelson Brigham stressed to me, any insurgency, counterinsurgency, is essentially a police affair, not a military affair, because you have to have informants in the civilian population. You have to have these secret interrogation centers where you can work the civilians over and a system of court set up where you can send them to prison and coerce them extra legally. And you have to have these modus vivendi through these agent penetration operations that protect the secret policemen. So they don't have to worry about getting bumped off, and they can operate for years, and you corrupt them and you give them all sorts of money and gadgets and in some cases Swiss bank accounts so that they'll let you do all these extra legal things. And these systems have all been perfected in the 75 years that the CIA has been operating, and now they're computerized and now they're assimilated into the internet and all the digital things that are going on, and the guidelines with the military are refined. It's absolutely misinformation and in some cases disinformation by people in the media, left, right, central, it doesn't matter, to think that somehow the military and the CIA are working at odds with each other. they are very closely coordinated. They're indistinguishable from each other. And especially when it comes to the special forces, they're basically the same thing. And in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, the CIA and the Joint Special Operations Command are absolutely compatible and indistinguishable.
In the Province Interrogation Center program, were you told about torture when you were interviewing a lot of these people who had been in the Phoenix program in Vietnam?
Yeah, the guy who told me about it, this guy John Patrick Muldoon, said absolutely, you know, and he blamed it on the South Vietnamese. He said, well, the South Vietnamese use the old French methods, but of course, it's a secret program. I filed a Freedom of Information Act request for all the information that the CIA had on this PIC program, the Province Interrogation Center program. They won't release the files on it, but there are files detailing everything that happened in every one of these interrogation center programs. So the knowledge, again, is there. And of course, the ultimate was the Tiger Cages at Con Son Prison, 90 miles off the coast of South Vietnam, which was sort of the mother of all interrogation centers. And it was the place where all the high-ranking captured civilians who were in the National Liberation Front were sent. They were sent to Con Son Prison. And that's where the infamous Tiger Cages were, which were really no better than anything that was going on in these interrogation centers. It's just a concrete cell. People were shackled into position, into a sitting position, and left there for a year. Their legs would deteriorate. There were pictures after the ceasefire in 1972 of some of the people that were released. And they're actually sitting on little like skateboards because they couldn't use their legs anymore and just pushing themselves around. So the level of torture that was going on in these interrogation centers beyond anything you can imagine. And it's never been reported. And it's one of the deepest, darkest secrets of the CIA's involvement in the Vietnam War. And not only has it never been reported, but it'll never be. Nobody will ever be able to make a case because it amounted to war crimes on a massive scale, beyond what anybody could ever imagine. And like I said, these interrogation centers have become the model for like the black sites that the CIA sets up all around the world. Pacific Architects and Engineers was the construction company that designed them.
And finally, you write in your book on the Phoenix program, Phoenix symbolizes an aspect of the Vietnam War that changed forever the way Americans think about themselves and their government. Central to Phoenix is the fact that it targeted civilians, not soldiers.
Yeah. And guess what? The people that run our society feel the same way about us, the citizens of the United States, that they feel about the citizens of South Vietnam. And they may tell you that you're special because you're an American, but you're not. And as the income inequality divide gets bigger and bigger, and as the Department of Homeland Security spreads its informant nets and its the same programs that the CIA created in South Vietnam, as these, this is the same thing they have in store for us here. It's why it's important to understand the systems, how the systems are used to manipulate political and social movements, the systems behind political repression, which in the United States are highly refined, but we're civilians too. And all these programs that were perfected in South Vietnam and perfected over the years are being turned on us. And the historical arc is there, and you can see it happening before your eyes. And it's going in a predetermined direction, and it's not going to get any better.
Douglas Valentine, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Well, I wasn't successful this year. I've been trying to focus on positive news, and that is not particularly positive hour, I will admit. It grabbed my attention, and I thought, this really does deserve a wider audience. This is going to help people understand what's going on. And the next episode of Guns and Butter, 359, is also with Douglas Valentine, and also fairly depressing stuff. But I thought, let's give us some positive news. So as a reminder that alternative opinions were very much alive and well during the time of the Vietnam War, let's hear this famous speech, "This is Why I Am Opposed to the War in Vietnam," by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And to focus on the central idea of this episode, you may wish to compare and contrast his magnanimity with the close-mindedness of the CIA's, if they're not for us, they're against us, and if they're against us, then it doesn't matter what we do to these people.
The time has come for America to hear the truth about this tragic war. Now, I've chosen to preach about the war in Vietnam today because I agree with Dante that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a period of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality. There comes a time when silence is betrayal. The truth of these words is beyond doubt. But the mission to which they call us is the most difficult one. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom. There has never been such a monumental dissent during a war by the American people. Polls reveal that almost 15 million Americans explicitly oppose the war in Vietnam. Additional millions cannot bring themselves around to support it. This reveals that millions have chosen to move beyond the prophesying of smooth patriotism to the high grounds of firm dissent based upon the mandates of conscience and the reading of history. Now, of course, one of the difficulties in speaking out today grows out of the fact that there are those who are seeking to equate dissent with disloyalty. It's a dark day in our nation when high-level authorities will seek to use every method to silence dissent. Something is happening and people are not going to be silent. The truth must be told. And I say that those who are seeking to make it appear that anyone who opposes the war in Vietnam is a fool or a traitor or an enemy of our soldiers is a person who has taken a stand against the best in our tradition. Many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. And so this morning I speak to you on this issue because I am determined to take the gospel seriously. There is at the outset a very obvious an almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. Then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched the program broken as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor, so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic, destructive suction tube. And you may not know it, my friends, but it is estimated that we spend $500,000 to kill each enemy soldier, while we spend only $53 for each person classified as poor. And much of that $53 goes for salaries to people who are not poor. And so I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and attack it as such. Perhaps the more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and die in extraordinarily high proportion relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Harlem. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schoolroom. So we watch them in brutal solidarity burning the huts of a poor village. But we realize that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago or Atlanta. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problem. And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. America and most of its newspapers applauded me in Montgomery, and I stood before thousands of Negroes getting ready to riot when my home was bombed, and said, "We can't do it this way." They applauded us in the sit-in movement. We nonviolently decided to sit in at lunch counters. They applauded us on the freedom rides when we accepted blows without retaliation. Oh, the press was so noble in its applause and so noble in its praise when I was saying, "Be nonviolent toward Bull Connor." There's something strangely inconsistent about a nation and a press that will praise you when you say be nonviolent toward Jim Clark, but will curse and damn you when you say be nonviolent toward little brown Vietnamese children. There's something wrong with that press. Another burden of responsibility was placed upon me in 1964. And I cannot forget that the Nobel Peace Prize was not just something taking place, but it was a commission to work harder than I had ever worked before for the brotherhood of man. This is a calling that takes me beyond national allegiances, but even if it were not present, I would yet have to live with the meaning of my commitment to the ministry of Jesus Christ. To me, the relationship of this ministry to the making of peace is so obvious that I sometimes marvel at those who ask me why I am speaking against the war. Could it be that they do not know that the good news was meant for all men, for communists and capitalists, for their children and ours, for black and white, for revolutionary and conservative? Have they forgotten that my ministry is in obedience to the one who loved his enemies so fully that he died for them? What then can I say to the Viet Cong or to Castro or to Mao as a faithful minister to Jesus Christ? Can I threaten them with death? Or must I not share with them my life? There will be no meaningful solution until some attempt is made to know these people and hear their broken cries. And who are we supporting in Vietnam today? It's a man by the name of General Key, who fought with the French against his own people, and who said on one occasion that the greatest hero of his life is Hitler. This is who we are supporting in Vietnam today. Oh, our government and the press generally won't tell us these things, but God told me to tell you this morning. The truth must be told. And all the while, the people read our leaflets and received regular promises of peace and democracy and land reform. Now they languish under our bombs and consider us not their fellow Vietnamese, the real enemy. They see the children degraded by our soldiers as they beg for food. We have destroyed their two most cherished institutions, the family and the village. We have destroyed their land and their crops. This is the role our nation has taken, the role of those who make peaceful revolutions impossible by refusing to give up the privileges and the pleasures that comes from the immense profits of overseas investment. Now, I'm convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin to shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation are incapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our present policies. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth with righteous indignation. It will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West, investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries, and say this is not just. It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of Latin America and say this is not just. The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hands on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes and with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields, physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. And it is a sad fact that because of comfort complacency, a morbid fear of communism, our proneness to adjust to injustice, the Western nations that initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world have now become the arch anti-revolutionaries. Our only hope today lies in our ability to recapture the revolutionary spirit and go out into a sometimes hostile world, declaring eternal hostility to poverty, racism, and militarism. A genuine revolution of values means in the final analysis that our loyalties must become ecumenical rather than sectional. Every nation must now develop an overriding loyalty to mankind as a whole in order to preserve the best in their individual societies. This calls for a worldwide fellowship that lifts neighborly concern beyond one's tribe, race, class, and nation, is in reality a call for an all-embracing, unconditional love for all men. This oft-misunderstood and misinterpreted concept, so readily dismissed by the Nietzsches of the world as a weak and cowardly force, has now become an absolute necessity for the survival of mankind. Let me say finally that I oppose the war in Vietnam because I love America. I speak out against this war, not in anger, but with anxiety and sorrow in my heart, and above all with a passionate desire to see our beloved country stand as the moral example of the world. I speak out against this war because I'm disappointed with America. And there can be no great disappointment where there is no great love. I'm disappointed with our failure to deal positively and forthrightly with the triple evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism. We are presently moving down a dead-end road that can lead to national disaster. America has strayed to the far country of racism and militarism. All men are made in the image of God. All men are brothers. All men are created equal. Every man is an heir to a legacy of dignity and worth. Every man has rights that are neither conferred by nor derived from the state. They are God-given. Out of one blood, God made all men to dwell upon the face of the earth. What a marvelous foundation for any home. What a glorious and healthy place to inhabit. But America strayed away, and this unnatural excursion has brought only confusion and bewilderment. It has left hearts aching with guilt and minds distorted with irrationality. It is time for all people of conscience to call upon America to come back home. Come home, America. I call on Washington today. I call on every man and woman of goodwill all over America today. I call on the young men of America who must make a choice today. Take a stand on this issue. Tomorrow may be too late. And don't let anybody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, you're too arrogant. Now, it isn't easy to stand up for truth and for justice. Sometimes it means being frustrated. When you tell the truth and take a stand, sometimes it means losing a job, it means being abused and scorned. It may mean having a 7 or 8 year old child asking your daddy, why do you have to go to jail so much? But I've long since learned that to be a follower of Jesus Christ means taking up the cross. And my Bible tells me that Good Friday comes before Easter. Before the crown we wear, there is the cross that we must bear. Let us bear it. Bear it for truth. Bear it for justice. And bear it for peace. Let us go out this morning with that determination. And I have not lost faith. I'm not in despair. I haven't lost faith because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because the Bible is right. You shall reap what you sow. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when the lion and the lamb will lie down together, and every man will sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid, because the words of the Lord have spoken it. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when all over the world we will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last. With this faith, we'll sing it as we are getting ready to sing it now. Men will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And nations will not rise up against nations, neither shall they study war anymore. And I don't know about you, I ain't gonna study war no more.
I consistently find Martin Luther King very refreshing, I must admit. And it's a measure of the desperation of the cabal who assassinated him, that they couldn't even do so cleanly enough to keep his murder off their official government hands. In 1999, a civil trial found agents of the US government responsible for his assassination. And if you didn't know that, that's an indication of just how effective corporate control of the media is at setting the agenda. There was the O.J. Simpson trial at the same time. Of course, they could have sent reporters, but none of the large U.S. papers deemed that to be noteworthy finding. If you're interested in more such, I can recommend wikispooks.com, an accredited fake news source by the Washington Post, this being the new label for information outlets that the corporate media consensus are trying to discredit. So catch it while it's still online and uncensored, wikispooks.org. Now, let's continue with another great thinker as far as nonviolence, a man who spent a large part of his life reflecting on the importance of real deep peace and how human beings could ever get there, Marshall Rosenberg. He centered a lot of his thought on this avoiding of enemy images, which provided my inspiration for this show. And this is taken from an NVC training course, not sure exactly when. The speaker, of course, is Marshall Rosenberg.
Now, to go about social change of this variety, where we don't see people as evil who are doing the actions that we see interfering with our needs being fulfilled, to go about social change out of that energy requires at times doing some despair work. Despair work as defined by Joanna Macy. And this kind of despair work helps us to deal with the pain that we're feeling as a result of what is happening, out of sometimes our feeling of powerlessness to do anything about it. When we do the kind of despair work that Joanna Macy talks about, we transform our feeling of powerlessness and despair, and it helps us to come out with a transformative spirituality. That's a term that Ken Wilber terms to use the kind of consciousness, the kind of spirituality that supports our social change effort. It's a spirituality in which we are energized by our consciousness of how life can be better served in another way, and we come out with joy and pleasure at the image of how it can be, rather than be motivated by anger and bitterness toward the people who are presently creating the structures that are. When we have this transformative spirituality, we need to integrate it with political consciousness. We need to really understand how the structures are working that are oppressing us. We have to watch out for the kind of spirituality that simply gets us trying to get the right attitude within ourselves, that helps us to live happily and spiritually within a world where there's a lot of violence, out of the hope that if we can just transform ourselves, the energy radiating from us will contribute to change. I'm convinced that we need more than that kind of spirituality. We need a spirituality that not only helps us to transcend our bitterness and our anger, but that is integrated with a real consciousness of what is happening that's creating the violence, and that mobilizes us to create change, not just to hope that by purifying ourselves, the energy coming from us will create the change. One of my social change objectives for the last several years has been to do what I can do to contribute to transforming our judicial system from one based on the concept of retributive justice to one based on restorative justice. Our present judicial system, retributive justice, comes out of a spirituality that I'm very concerned about, that I feel does great violence on our planet. I talked about this in previous sessions. I'm talking about that kind of spirituality that is based on the concept that there are superiors who know what is right and who, on the basis of their judgments, have the right to punish or reward people. If people are judged as bad, then these people who call themselves superiors have a right to give these people what they deserve. This concept of deserve is central to the concept of retributive justice. And if the superior judges people as good, then they reward them. Our judicial system is based on this way of thinking, that there are people who know what's right and what's wrong and who therefore have the right to punish people when they deserve it. Within cultures that have this system, people in positions of authority use that concept of justice. So parents believe that since they are superior to children, they have the right to punish or reward them when they judge the child as deserving those treatments. Unfortunately, many teachers use the same form of spirituality based on these judgments by superiors. The concept that I'm interested in supporting is restorative justice, which is based on an entirely different way of thinking and leads to entirely different ways of exercising justice. Restorative justice has as its purpose to find ways of getting everyone's needs met so that peace and harmony can be retrieved when pain and conflict exist between parties. This kind of spirituality that looks for ways of getting everybody's needs met, that doesn't judge people as evil and deserving of punishment, it looks at a threefold situation. There's three parties that have to be dealt with whenever somebody's needs have not been met through a crime of some sort. There's the person who's been affected by the crime. We want to end in a way that this person is brought back to healing and in which their needs are fulfilled. A second party in this kind of justice is the person who acted in a way that created pain for others. We want to restore the situation by replacing whatever education led to this person behaving as they did is now replaced with an education that supports their contributing to people's well-being rather than doing things which create suffering for people. And the third party involved in restorative justice is the community that provided the education that contributed to the person's crime. We need to look at why is it that some people get their needs met by robbing, raping, and doing other things that cause great suffering. The old spirituality says this is because such people are evil and deserving to be punished and suffer for their actions. The spirituality of restorative justice says that these people are meeting their needs in the way they have been educated to meet their needs. So we need to have the surrounding community look at how are we providing education for people, and how have we failed in this situation, and what do we need to do to support this person learning a different way, and to look at how we are educating people, and to make sure we are educating people to see that our well-being is one and the same, that we can never meet our own needs at other people's expense. Now, this concept of restorative justice is not a new one. There are many cultures throughout the world that have historically always used restorative justice and still do. Anthropologists Margaret Mead, Ruth Benedict, Ashley Montague have studied these cultures and describe how different is their spirituality and how different is their way of dealing with people who act in a way that creates pain and disharmony. So I'd like to now talk about what restorative justice looks like in these cultures that go about seeing justice in a radically different way, whose spirituality does not believe that people are evil or good. It believes that we all, when we're functioning in harmony with our nature, enjoy more than anything else contributing to one another's well-being. And therefore, when they see people doing things that contribute to pain on the part of others, that violate the rights of others, they do not interpret these people as evil or bad. They believe that the people must have forgotten the power they have to enrich life and how good it is to contribute to people's well-being. And therefore, they surround them with people who know them. And they have a circle in which these people around them remind them of all of the things that they have done that has enriched their lives. Because their spirituality doesn't imply that this person did what they did because they're evil and deserve to be punished. They believe that a person would only act that way if something has disconnected them, has made them forget that the good life is how we contribute to one another's well-being.
And what a different world we would live in if we took a restorative rather than a retributive approach to justice. If whatever had happened, we drew a line under that and said, well, that was the past. How can we move forward together in a productive, in a healthy fashion? Might find huge numbers of prisoners free to go about their productive business. To use other words to express the same idea, we might find a lot of people unemployed. Money, of course, is one of the main means whereby people are encouraged to feel that they have no option but to do things that they're not actually spiritually in tune with. Now let's hear one relevant example to our discussion of enemy images. This comes to us courtesy of the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. It's a video interview, and the sound is actually sufficient for my purposes. But I will link to the original in case you're on the web and you'd like to see the interview. This is from 2016, and the speaker is Martin Wells, a former employee of public relations company Bell Pottinger from 2006 to 2008. And I believe I'm right in suggesting that Bell Pottinger got a large slice of hundreds of millions of dollars from the US Defense Department for their assistance in creating enemy images to boost the Defense Department's business.
I got a phone call from my agency, who I worked with and got lots of work from, saying, would you like to work abroad? You've got an interesting role. I was like, okay, yeah, but the interview's tomorrow. You need to get here for the interview tomorrow. And I was like, okay, yeah, no problem at all. I'll come on up. The address I was given was in central London. I went into the building, up to the sixth floor, and there were guards on the sixth floor, which I thought was quite odd. And it turned out to be a military media kind of intelligence unit. And they showed me around. We had a quick chat, and I must have been there for about 20 minutes, and that was it. And they said, right, great to see you, thanks very much. And I asked, okay, so when will I hear if I've got the job? And they said, oh, no, you've got it. And said, where am I going? When do I start? They said, well, your tickets will be emailed to you later today. You'll be going out on Monday morning. Okay, this is a Friday. I'm talking to these guys. And I said, so where am I going? Oh, you're going to Baghdad. I was expecting to be in the green zone. But no, we were on a base called Camp Victory, which surprised me. So when I first arrived at the building that I was going to be working at, it struck me that it was a very secure building. Signs outside saying, do not come in. If you're not it's a classified area. If you're not cleared, you can't come in. So when I first started working there, I didn't know how big a project this was. I just assumed it was news gathering. But having seen the process and worked in the process, I then realised this was a big project. And the budget was large as well for this project. It was around about $120 million a year for this project. And that's a lot of money. Whilst I was working there, there were three different types of strand, really. So we would do the news items that would go out on the news and go out on various channels locally. The kind of stories, a bomb would go off, a car bomb would go off, people would die. We would have people out there filming it. It would come back. We would then edit it into stories that would then go out on various channels within the region. And we were to make it, as best we could, look as if it was made locally, which it is shot locally and is edited locally. It was more to make it look like it was Arabic, to make it look like it was shot in the region, which it was, but to make it look like it was created by Arabic TV almost. So it was given the impression that this was done by an Arabic company, in my view. And then there were what they call TVCs, which are television commercials, say Al-Qaeda are bad. There would also be things called VCDs, which we would make. The Wales approach about VCDs was, I was asked by my boss, we need to make this style of video, and we've got to use Al-Qaeda's footage and all their propaganda out there to do it. We need it to be 10 minutes long, and it needs to be in this file format, and we need to encode it in this manner. And yeah, that's great. And we're going to track it via Google Analytics. All the VCDs that were made, and quite a considerable amount, were taken by Marines when they were going into various villages or they were doing raids, whatever patrols they were on, and they were dispersed that way. That was the quickest, easiest, and also, I guess, the most sensible way of doing it. Because if they're raiding a house and they're going to make a mess of it looking for stuff anyway, they just drop an odd VCD there. Then when whoever comes back, they're going to pick it up and they're going to start checking stuff through. So it kind of made sense to do it that way. And these were discs that were made to play in a thing called Real Player. And what happened to a Real Player is you'd get a white screen before anything would happen. They came up with this ingenious idea that within the white flash that Real Player does, it actually tracks where the VCD is being played. Because Real Player has to connect online to run, that little bit of code would then be connected to a Google Analytics account. And so that way you could have a track and know where that VCD is being played. So when the VCDs have been delivered, when they're watched and the tracking kicks, it makes a hit with analytics. When you log into it, 24 hours later, it will tell you which IP address and where in the world it's been looked at. So, for instance, if one's looked at in the middle of Baghdad, okay, you know there's a hit there. If one 48 hours later or a week later shows up in another part of the world, then that's the more interesting one. And that's what they're looking for more, because then that gives you a trail of, okay, so someone sent it to this person, or they've been here and they've gone elsewhere. So it gives you a track of somebody who could possibly be a threat. Some of the VCDs ended up in some interesting countries. I think I had a couple in Iran. Obviously, in Iraq, in several places. I think there was one in Syria, but the most interesting one was in America. No idea how it got there. But all my job was to do was to collate that data and pass it on. So I would do a printout for the day, and if anything interesting popped up, hand it over to the bosses, and then it would be dealt with from there. When we made something, the process would be, I would show it to my producer, they'd be happy with it. We would then get in seniors in the office, they'd be happy with it. Then we get the two colonels in to look at it, look at the things we'd done throughout the day. They'd be fine with it. It would then go to General Petraeus. He would then look at it and his team would look at it. And if they're happy with it, it would then go on up the line if it needed to. If he couldn't sign off on it, it would go up on the line to the White House, and then it was signed off up there, and the answer would come back down the line. I was in and out of Baghdad on this contract for over a year or so. I just couldn't do it any longer. When you've got over 500 tapes with more atrocities than you can believe could ever be committed to another human being on, there's only so much you can take. And also, you just think, flying in and out of a war zone all the time, you're elevating that risk of not being able to come back home.
So on the face of it, a fairly straightforward job situation where you have to do a task that's allotted, pass it up the line, someone else checks it, passes it up the line. A very familiar task to a lot of people in the 21st century. I think the further we go back, the less this would seem like an ordinary state of affairs. And on the evidence of what Martin Wells said towards the end, somebody obviously was very keen to expose him to a lot of videos of people abusing one another. Now, where did those productions of his actually go? Did they get up to the White House or not? Well, he wasn't there, he doesn't know, and he's not paid to know. Or you might even say he's paid not to know. How many of us, how many people who paid do so exactly that we can close our eyes and ears or close our mind to the consequences of particular pieces of work we happen to be involved in? Seems to me that this money thing is more or less the crux of the enemy images. Not many of us are actually involved in a war situation. Not many of us are involved in creating images of enemies. We may or may not be exposed to lots of fear of terrorism, roughly according to how much commercially controlled media we consume. But I think the fear of running out of money, whether it's conscious or subconscious, is probably present in a lot more of our psyches. Not actually a natural human fear, of course. We know what hunger is, we know what homelessness is, but this tying of it to an abstract variable. In reality, there's plenty more places to live than there are people, looking at things like offices and things like hotels, and yet many, many people are forced by guys with guns to sleep out. Now, that is, to put it another way, capitalist society thrives on enemy images. If we didn't have enemy images, we wouldn't have capitalism. If we're using money, then we are not in a gift situation. I love the idea of a gift economy. There are people who have said to me, Robin, that's not practical. Just as it's not practical to do without defense against terrorism. But the more I look at this, the more it comes to my mind, actually, the counter-terrorists are in league with the terrorists. That, again, when all said and done, the risks of terrorism are far, far less than risks of dying in a traffic accident, never mind preventable diseases like lung cancer. So it's being used to manipulate people by the people whom we heard about at the start of the show, those people who have been educated to show little concern about destroying the fabric of the South Vietnamese society when they felt it didn't serve their needs. Now, for more insight onto that type of mentality, for more insight into the programming which is undertaken by them, we've got a short section of a video. I couldn't find the whole video, but we have 4 and a bit minutes. There's some quite powerful images here, so I'm going to link to the original from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/746. This was turned up by The Intercept, and it's a video in which the Pentagon warn of an unavoidable dystopian future for the world's biggest cities. It's ripe with questionable assumptions, in my mind. As I say, powerful visuals to help it stick in the mind, for example, of a young and easily influenced army recruit, full of goodwill, patriotism, and a desire to serve his fellow man by defending his country against terrorism, for example. And doesn't have a date attached, but I think it's from 2016. Mega cities, urban future, the emerging complexity.
The future is urban. By 2030, urban areas are expected to grow by 1.4 billion, with that growth occurring almost entirely in the developing world. Cities will account for 60% of the world's population and 70% of the world's GDP. The urban environment will be the locus where drivers of instability will converge. It is the domain that by the year 2030, 60% of urban dwellers will be under the age of 18. The cities that grow the fastest will be the most challenged as resources become constrained and illicit networks fill the gap left by overextended and undercapitalized governments. The risk of natural disasters compounded by geography, climate changes, unregulated growth, and substandard infrastructure intersect to frustrate humanitarian relief. Growth will magnify the increasing separation between rich and poor. Religious and ethnic tensions will be a defining element in the social landscape. Stagnation will coexist with unprecedented development as impoverishment, slums, and shanty towns rapidly expand alongside modern high-rises, technological advances, and ever-increasing levels of prosperity. This is the world of our future. It is one we are not prepared to effectively operate within, and it is unavoidable. Megacities are complex systems where people and structures are compressed together in ways that defy both our understanding of city planning and military doctrine. It is an ecosystem that demands a highly agile and adaptive force to successfully operate within. Infrastructures will vary radically, with concentrations of high-tech transportation, globally connected air and seaports, contemporary water, utilities, and waste disposal intermixed with open landfills, overburdened sewers, polluted water, and makeshift power grids. Living habitats will extend from the high-rise to the ground-level cottage to subterranean labyrinths, each defined by its own social code and rule of law. Social structures will be equally challenged, if not dysfunctional, as historic ways of life clash with modern living, ethnic and racial differences are forced to live together, and criminal networks offer opportunity for the growing mass of unemployed. This becomes the nervous system of non-nation-state, unaligned individuals and organizations that live and work in the shadows of national rule. Where physical domains can be seen, digital domains will have limitless potential to breed and expand without limit. Digital security and trade will be increasingly threatened by sophisticated illicit economies and decentralized syndicates of crime to give adversaries global reach at an unprecedented level. This will add to the complexities of human targeting, as a proportionally smaller number of adversaries intermingle with a larger and increasing number of citizens. The scale and density of these domains is daunting. In a city of 10 million, where you hold the support of 99% of the population, the remaining 1% represents a threat of 100,000. It is an environment of convergence, hidden amongst the enormous scale and complexity of the megacity. These are the future breeding grounds, incubators, and launching pads for adversaries and hybrid threats. Linked globally, these are man-made labyrinths that provide refuge and movement across the vast sections of these cities where alternate forms of governance have taken control. The advice of doctrine, from Sun Tzu to current field manuals, has provided two fundamental options. avoid the cities, or establish a cordon to either wait out the adversary or drain the swamp of non-combatants and engage the remaining adversaries in high-intensity conflict within. Even our counterinsurgency doctrine, honed in the cities of Iraq and the mountains of Afghanistan, is inadequate to address the sheer scale of population in the future urban reality. From the streets of Aachen to the citadel in Wei, we have defeated adversaries who attempted to use urban terrain to their advantage. Urban conflict is written deep into the Army's histories. But in tomorrow's conflict, these megacities are orders of magnitude greater in complexity, and our current options do not meet strategic ends. Our future operations must allow us to...
Now, I'm afraid that's where my video closes rather abruptly. So, particularly if you've seen the images, I think you will agree that that 5 minutes of Pentagon prognostication is saturated in enemy images. Not a lot of US flags on offer, a lot of people fighting, riots, various different squalid situations, suffering, not an optimistic vision of the future. A stark contrast with my ambitions, my hopes for the future, and I think the hopes of a very large proportion of humanity. A world of people happy to meet one another's needs, happy to be part of the solution for 100% of us, not for 99%, and certainly not for 1%. It doesn't seem to me that we're going to get to that situation under the current set of assumptions. I've focused this time on enemy images. I did just about manage to avoid going into one about money, but yes, money has been very, very effective through millennia as a tool of divide and conquer, a deliberately scarce fictional resource which is created, conjured up out of nothing, one might almost say, in order to set brother against brother, worker against worker. And I think a lot of shallow observations about human nature can be put down to a result of the scarcity that is endemic in those societies where human interaction is heavily mediated by use of money. In this episode, I've looked more at enemy images. This is certainly not intended as an abstract set of thoughts. I started with Douglas Valentine on South Vietnam and the Phoenix Program. The next episode of Guns and Butter, which I think I might put in Unwelcome Guests, shows that he's clearly done a lot of thinking about what the implications are for US society, as he made quite clear with that initial quote. He's not of the opinion that that's what US citizens do when they're abroad. When they're at home, it somehow changes. If we apply that cold, calculating logic to domination of a foreign society, it's very clear US as invaders and how they could seek to subjugate that society, such a small number of them, albeit with technical superiority as far as delivering of death through technical devices. And what about looking at the US in the 21st century with these fusion centers, with various different supposed counter-terror operations? Well, we know the etymology of the counter-terrorists. They were the people who went into the villages and committed atrocities. It doesn't give me a lot of hope for the humanity and the mercy of the counter-terror as dished up 21st century style. Now, remembering we have the likes of Bell Pottinger, other such public relations firms, to spend the US taxpayers' dollars on terrorizing the US taxpayers, one huge part of this military-industrial complex that we haven't really looked at is the so-called defense industry, that is to say, the arms industry. I think we're probably due a look at that, how that fits in. Of course, they have very direct economic interest in promulgating these enemy images. Now, we've looked in the past a lot at false flag operations. That is, of course, only a small, albeit active, part of this mythology of competition, this mythology of these radical, violent extremists who are so ruthless that they can only be successfully opposed by the powers of nation states. I remain fundamentally optimistic about the world and the fact that I have the source material freely available on the internet to make this kind of social critique suggests to me that because it's based on deception and all the information needed to prove a point is out there, it's a fundamentally unstable proposition. I don't think this is people with a long-term plan. Yeah, this is how we're going to bring in a technological control grid. There may be some people with some of those aspirations. I think this is people motivated by fear, their own enemy images, kicking the can down the road and doing what they thought worked last time. I think in the longer term, well, humanity, to think about climate change, to pick just one example, does have some really serious issues to address, and the sooner we can kick these enemy images into touch, the sooner we can get down to looking at the real issues about how we're going to survive on this planet. How can we alleviate the worst of the effects which we've already set in train? This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. And if you'd like to download them 100 at a time, you can do so from the downloads page. Many thanks again to Bonnie Faulkner and Douglas Valentine for the inspirational interview, and to GDR Playing Field for reminding me that I was still interested in making the occasional Unwelcome Guests episode. And thanks to everybody who's given me feedback on the show.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, Fascism, the False Revolution. The overwhelming response from those who heard part one of this program was disbelief. How can an analysis made in 1995 be so relevant for 2017? The talk, Fascism, the False Revolution, by the political analyst and author Michael Parenti, was recorded before a standing room audience of 1,200 in Berkeley, California. In part one of this talk, Parenti gave a history lesson about the origins of fascism in Italy and Germany. He pointed out very interesting similarities of fascism over time and place.
One of the things conveniently overlooked by mainstream scholar propagandists is the way that Western capitalist states have tolerated and cooperated with fascism. Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, as you know, was positively cozy. He and many of his class saw Hitler as a bulwark against communism in Germany, and they saw Nazi Germany as a bulwark against communism in Europe. After World War II, the Western capitalist allies did little to eradicate fascism from Italy or Germany, except for the Nuremberg trials. But the police, the courts, the military, security agencies, the bureaucracy have remained largely staffed by those who had served the former Nazi regimes or their ideological recruits. And that remains true to this day. I mean, how do you murder 6 million Jews, 250,000 gypsies, several million Ukrainians, Russians, Poles, and others, and thousands of homosexuals, and get away with it? Unless the only way you get away with it is that the very people who are supposed to look into these crimes were themselves complicit. What happened to the U.S. businesses that collaborated with fascism? Corporations like DuPont, Ford, General Motors, ITT, they own factories in these enemy countries that produce fuel, tanks, and planes that wreak havoc on Allied forces during World War II. And after the war, instead of being prosecuted for treason, ITT collected $27 million from the U.S. government for war damages inflicted on its German plants by Allied bombings. General Motors collected $33 million. Pilots were given instructions not to hit certain factories. The devastation of Cologne. There were several factories owned by ITT and Chrysler that after a while the German people learned to go in there and use them for air raid shelters because they wouldn't get hit by the American pilots because they were owned by the American corporate interests. Since the war, U.S. leaders have done their part in keeping Italian fascism alive, giving millions of dollars to right-wing organizations and neo-fascist organizations in Italy. In 1975, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger met with the Italian fascist leader Giorgio Almirante in Washington to discuss what alternatives might be considered should the Italian communists win the election and take control of the government. Over the years, fascist terror groups have engaged in assassinations and bombings in any number of Western European countries to destabilize the existing democracies, what's called the strategy of tension. While the U.S. press focused on the Red Brigades, some Italian newspapers pointed out that most of the killings and the other acts of violence were perpetrated by fascist groups, most of which were shown a generous tolerance by the police. As you all know, a coalition of neo-fascist and separatist groups headed by media tycoon Silvio Berlusconi won the 1994 elections in Italy. Their platform, a single tax rate for rich and poor alike, school vouchers, a stripping away of the welfare state, the introduction of private retirement accounts, and of course, the privatization of just about everything. Ladies and gentlemen, the Italian neo-fascists are learning from the American reactionaries how to achieve fascism's goals under democratic forms with democratic facades. You use an upbeat Reagan-esque optimism. You convince people that government is the enemy, especially its social democracy aspects. At the same time, you strengthen the repressive capacities of the state. You instigate resentments against the newly arrived immigrants. That's going on in Italy right now. And you preach the imaginary virtues of the free market. So we might do well to stop thinking of fascism as a simple either-or condition. The political system of any one country encompasses a variety of seemingly incongruous institutional practices. I mean, to insist that you don't have fascism until every vestige of constitutional government is destroyed and the jackboot is right on our necks is to really overlook the very disturbingly anti-democratic manifestations inherent in many states that call themselves democracies, especially in their dealings with left dissenters. You know, the political center is always described as kind of the moderate place between the extremes of left and right, and fighting a war on two fronts against right and left. A closer reading of history should tell us that the center is more inclined to make common cause with the right against the left. And this is because the center and the right share a commitment to corporate capitalism and the free market mythology. Throughout the Weimar Republic, Franz Neumann, he wrote, I quote, "Every law aimed supposedly against both communists and Nazis was invariably enforced against the entire left, but rarely against anyone on the right." Unquote. Well, I'm paraphrasing. This is Neumann actually going on his thought. Those leftists who were critical of the illegal rearmament of Germany during the Weimar found themselves charged and tried for treason, while rightist assassins and pushists were, quote, either not prosecuted at all or dealt with lightly. Now, this double standard of the centrist state in dealing with the left and right, I would say, continues to this day in the United States and most other Western capitalist nations. I mean, consider how, for generations, how gently the murderous lynching night riders, the Ku Klux Klan, was treated by federal authorities in this country. Compare that to the way the Black Panthers were treated. Consider how the right is investigated compared to the left. When the Center for Cuban Studies in New York was bombed by a right-wing Cuban group, which boasted, admitted they did the act, the FBI didn't have a clue, couldn't find them. Just a couple of weeks ago, I got a call from the FBI myself. The guy says, "I'm not making this up." They said, "Mr. Parenti, we'd like to come and see you because we have a charge here that you may be the Unabomber." They said, "Sir, could we come and talk to you?" I said, "I wouldn't miss this for the world." I'm not going to go any further. You'll see the movie. The way the mainstream shades off into the fascist right can be seen quite clearly in the Republican Party. The GOP agenda today is really not much different from the kind pushed by Mussolini and Hitler. It's fascism without the swastika. It's fascism in a pinstripe suit. First, break the labor unions, depress wages, impose a rightist ideological monopoly over the media. The rest of the GOP agenda, as you know, eliminate cultural dissidents in the arts, attack the rights of women and gays, abolish taxes for the big corporations and the rich, eliminate government regulations designed for worker and consumer safety and environmental protection, privatize and plunder public lands and enterprises, wipe out public services, and cloak this whole reactionary agenda in a kind of a revolutionary sound. You know, Newt Gingrich, we're talking about the GOP revolution. We got a revolution going here in Congress. Some revolution. It's the same old reactionary class agenda. And today in the United States, we witness some middle-class Americans, like the middle-class Germans of yore, beset by real economic difficulties. They really are facing economic injustices, real ones, and they're turning their anger toward irrelevant or imaginary foes, the immigrants, the Jews, the poor, the welfare mothers, people of color, feminists, gays, atheists, and others. There's something else I think that's happened that explains the speed up of reactionism in America today, and that is the fact that for years, the United States leaders and political and economic elites saw themselves in mortal combat with communism for the allegiance of peoples at home and abroad. The argument was made that U.S. workers enjoyed a higher standard of living than their counterparts who lived under communism. It was a very conscious thing. Civil rights, too, the same thing. If we've got to compete with the communists for all these third world countries, people of color, we've got to clean up our act, get rid of Jim Crow, segregation, all that sort of thing. That was always a theme. Our workers earn more. Our workers live better than anybody under communism. You live better. Stick with capitalism. Free enterprise is the best for you. And that was a conscious thing. The pressure of being in competition with an anti-capitalist alternative system set limits on how thoroughly the higher circles dared to mistreat the working populace. I mean, I don't want to overstate that. I mean, long before the collapse of communism, they tried to break unions, they tried to depress wages, they tried to do all these things. But now, I mean, they're pulling out the stops, they're dropping all pretenses at capitalism with a human face, you know. And they were always mindful. These people were always mindful of the potential threat of workers getting radicalized. Very much so in the 1930s, very much so in the 60s and even the 70s, and it comes out in their statements and all that. And by the way, of course, that wasn't the only restraining factor. It was also the working class's ability to fight back, to win democratic victories, gains, the eight-hour day, any number of historic victories, Social Security and various benefits and the like. When the communist nations were overthrown in Eastern Europe, there was much rejoicing among conservative circles. But within a very short time, there was a very interesting, querulous, irritated, irate note that began to appear in some of the conservative publications that I looked at. And it went like this. If in Eastern Europe, they're now moving toward a total free market, why must we here in the United States still have to tolerate these collectivistic, liberalish regulations and restraints that are put upon us? Now is the time to cast off all restraint and sock it to the public. The competition for their hearts and minds are over. There's no competing system to which they might think of turning. There's no need to tolerate any accommodation with those who have to work for a living. There's no reason why masses of people in this country should have a middle-class living standard, why working people should have that, or even so many middle-class people. It's time that these people lower their expectations, work harder, and be satisfied with less. The more they get, the more they'll demand, and we'll end up with a social democracy, or worse. Better to keep them down and hungry with their noses to the grindstone. It's time to return to the good old days. In Against Empire, I call it getting back to 1893. The kind of conditions that prevail in the third world have a weak, unorganized, demoralized mass of people that work for subsistence. You have even below them a large contingent of desperately poor unemployed who help further to depress wages and can often become the object of resentment by the people just above them. And you have a small, insecure middle class that's hanging on by its bleeding fingers. And above that, a very tiny, obscenely rich owning class that has it all. Also, a change in attitude toward the Third World. During the Cold War and the competition with the Soviet Union, the whole option was development. We'll develop these countries, prosperity will come in, give them aid, and middle class will develop, they'll get stabilized, and they will not succumb to the appeals of communism. Well, with the collapse of communism, there's been a shift in policy there too. First of all, they found that policy wasn't working. Third world governments began to close off key sectors of their economy. Yeah, that's the only way you're going to develop it, is to close it off against U.S. capital competition. They were doing things like forming consortiums for better trade deals and better money deals. They were trying to break the global monopoly of Western media. They were looking for more authority over their own seabeds and resources and that sort of thing. And then they were producing goods that were competing with the U.S. market, even at home. So the new policy toward the Third World is also a hard line. As with their own working class in the U.S., so with Third World nations now. You've got nowhere else to go. You're not going to turn to Moscow now. Moscow's in our pocket. And so, bam, they're hitting him hard. The IMF, the World Bank, GATT, NAFTA, and undermining the sovereignty of Third World nations, making an end run around them, directly plundering their markets and drastically cutting non-military foreign aid to these countries. And in some cases, directly invading them and destroying the government that had any reformist tendencies or was maintaining economic development, as in the case of Iraq, Panama, and in, of course, a dozen reformist revolutionary governments. They've done that. So they don't have to worry about a communist competitor. U.S. leaders are making war against economic nationalism in countries like India, Brazil, Mexico, Iraq, Panama, South Korea, Taiwan, and so forth. There's a lot of people who still don't get it. They don't get it that these guys are playing for keeps, that they are going after you, that they are not going to leave any little bit left for you. There's only one thing that the ruling circles throughout history have ever wanted, and that's everything. There's only one thing they want. All the wealth, the treasures, and the profitable returns. All the choice lands and forests and game and herds and harvests and mineral deposits and precious metals of the earth. All the productive facilities and gainful inventiveness and technologies. All the control positions of the state and other major institutions. All public supports and subsidies, privileges and immunities. All the protections of the law and none of its constraints. All the services and comforts and luxuries and advantages of civil society with none of the taxes and none of the costs. Every ruling class in history has wanted only this. All the rewards and none of the burdens. Their operational code is, we have a lot, we can get more, we want it all. And if you don't know that, you're in a sad place. If you know that and you don't know anything else, you know more than if you know everything else and you don't know that. In the final analysis, the danger of fascism comes not from skinheads or the militia or the Christian right fanatics, but it comes from the ongoing practices of the national security state and its various enforcement agencies. It comes from the boardrooms of corporate America. But before we pronounce ourselves doomed, keep in mind that at the present time, right in these days now, there are people who are demonstrating and getting arrested and raising hell to protect the environment and the forests. There are others who are doing the same at nuclear submarine bases. There are people who are demonstrating for justice and against racism in the judicial system as the national protests for Mumia Abu-Jamal demonstrate. There are people protesting against nuclear testing in the South Pacific, against Medicare cuts and family assistance cuts, against the suppression of the homeless, against the anti-immigration laws, and for affirmative action. There are large majorities in this country who even support welfare, if you don't call it welfare. If you say, should government help the poor? Should government do more for the poor? It's surprising what people say. Well, we have to get a lot angrier and a lot more determined. They want everything, and everything is at stake. Many people are getting angrier and angrier and increasingly concerned. Our job is to see that they direct their anger at the real perpetrators of their misery and not against the very people who want to make common cause with them. Well, Parenti, what do you have against wealth? All the time I hear this talk. I mean, it trickles down, and more wealth, more wealth up there means more down for the rest of us. I just heard that recently by the ruling class propagandist Rush Limbaugh, the best mind on the right. He said, quote, this is pretty high-level stuff for Rush Limbaugh. He said, it's not a zero-sum society. A bigger pie is better for all. No, it is a zero-sum society, because the size of the pie is one thing, how it's sliced is another. If you take a 20-ounce pie, in which I got a 10% slice, and you shrink it down to a 15-ounce pie, and I now get a 70% slice, I like the 15-ounce pie better, at least the plutocrats would. And wealth doesn't trickle down. It is siphoned up from the labor of the many into the pockets of the few. I don't like great concentrations of private wealth because it causes public poverty. Corporate wealth is the greatest single cause of poverty. It is theft, and it makes a mockery of democracy. In fact, in every society where you have wealth, you have poverty. That's how you get wealth, by creating poverty. That's how the slave owner could live in such opulence and luxury, by having slaves who work at a bare subsistence and create this for him. That's how the feudal lords could live with their refineries and luxuries and their tables laden and groaning with food, by having serfs and servants working and producing this. And in the societies where you don't have great concentrations of wealth, you generally don't have mass poverty, or very little of it. It's a very interesting correlation. Wealth causes poverty, and that's what I got against wealth. Brothers and sisters, when labor is in retreat, when the power of capital is increasingly untrammeled, all of us are put at risk. The environment, the sacred forests, the beautiful and mysterious creatures of the sea, the ordinary people who with their strength and brains and inventiveness create community and give to life so much that's worthy of our respect. The real burden to society is not the poor, but the corporate rich. We simply can no longer afford them. Conservatives complain whenever we fight back, and whenever we criticize their anti-democratic class privilege, they say we're engaging in class war. I mean, they engage in class war on our heads all the time, every day. Everything they do, every newspaper, every political ploy and move is doing this. Every lie they tell is consciously doing that. The minute we fight back and try to expose it, they say, oh, you're engaging in class war. Well, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, I believe it is class war. But I also have another name for it. When people unite against the abuses of wealth and privilege, when they activate themselves and militantly attack the hypocrisies and lies of the powers that be, when they fight back and become the active agents of their own destiny, when they withdraw their empowering responses and refuse to toe that line, I have another name for that. I call that democracy. Their first loyalty is to the dollar. Our first loyalty is to democracy and to the well-being of our society and our Mother Earth. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
That was the conclusion of Fascism, the False Revolution, by Dr. Michael Parenti. This talk was given to a standing room audience of 1,200 in Berkeley, California, on September 23, 1995.
You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us. Someone who looks at the way surveillance has a role in this capitalist society is my next guest, Christian Parenti. Dr. Christian Parenti is the author of several books. His latest book is Tropical Chaos, and we talked to him today about his last two books, Lockdown America and The Soft Cage, which speaks about the prison system in North America. Thank you again for joining us.
You're welcome. Fire away. What are the questions?
Wonderful.
What do people not yet understand about policing and prisons in the United States? I've been having this conversation for nigh on 15 years now. And frequently there are these resort to economistic answers coming from the left. The right, of course, says, well, you know, we're trying to regain order in a society riven by crime, et cetera, et cetera. But then the left resorts to these economistic answers about, well, it's private prisons and the exploitation of prison labor. And that's not really the explanation.
You know, I actually am glad that you said that, because I don't hold either one of those positions. For me, being from Latin America, I seem to think, or at least I feel, that there is a connection between the repressive nature of prisons and the culture of neoliberalism. I think that the violence is a protective force as well.
You were in a minority of people who correctly apprehend how the thing works. That's exactly right. And it's not just the culture of neoliberalism, it's the actual economic policies of neoliberalism that produce poverty deliberately and also unintentionally. They produce it deliberately. There needs to be a high rate of unemployment to keep wages down, so there's an element of deliberate production of unemployment. You know, if any time the economy gets going, you know, too robustly, there's always concern about keeping the, you know, determining what the natural rate of unemployment is and taking efforts to make sure that there are always more people looking for jobs than there are people to fill jobs, lest wages start being bid up and cutting into the capitalist class's profits. And unemployment is also created unintentionally because, you know, when you remove all the Keynesian social democratic forms of regulation and control, the business cycle is, you know, back in full swing. And so you get increased volatility, you know, more frequent bubbles and more frequent crashes. And in those crashes, as in the crash of 2008, which carries on, there's production of massive amounts of unemployment, just sort of indirectly, unintentionally, you know, but as a result of the business cycle. So then the question is, in a capitalist society, if for the sake of keeping wages low, there must be unemployment, how are the poor to be managed physically, and how are they as a category, as a political category, to be managed? I.e., how are they to be managed discursively? How are they to be described? How are they to be explained to themselves and others to make them politically vulnerable to unburden the state and the wealthy classes of any responsibility for providing for them? And so that's where the whole criminal justice crackdown fits in that it can both physically control large elements of the poor and keep their communities under surveillance and police occupation, and also simultaneously ideologically control them by promoting a story of danger and threat and moral failure and individual responsibility that explains away high rates of poverty as cultural phenomena rooted in individual failures to get up early and work hard, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, one of the important things I think that we need to make is that this culture of internalizes also in the population a sense of self-blaming. I'd rather see that the prison system produces the criminal. You know what I mean? Like, they're both self-constitutive, right? As long as we create this culture of criminality, or instead of looking at the root causes, which you just addressed, the wealth inequality, the inequality, the wealth distribution, inequality, instead of addressing those issues, we instead create this narrative that the victims themselves become self-censoring. You know, I mean, we ourselves start to think, well, he must have done something. So I wonder if you could talk about that relationship, because I think that's where we're stuck, sure. Right?
And again, it works both physically and discursively. So you could say prison produces criminals in that it produces actual criminality. You know, if you go to prison, particularly when you're young, instead of going to school, instead of, you know, when you're being socialized, instead of learning a skill and learning appropriate social skills to operate in society and in the labor market, instead you learn how to operate in the criminal underworld, yes, prison definitely produces real criminality. People who come out, they're marked. It's harder for them to get, they're legally marked. They have a conviction. It's harder for them to get a job. They have less skills, et cetera, et cetera. You know, to put it in mainstream parlance, you know, they have the equivalent of like a Rolodex of what? Of criminals, you know? So they know how to, you know, fence goods, sell drugs, whatever, whatever. So it produces actual criminality, but then it also produces the legal category of criminality, whether or not one is an actual doing moral harm or physical harm to others. You know, you can wind up back in prison. Basically, it produces recidivism because the laws around probation and parole are, you know, incredibly intricate and intense. And so it's very hard for people to be out on parole for very long and not violate their parole. And so, you know, in some states in the United States, you know, up to half of all the people entering prison are going in for parole violations. You know, it's usually not more than half. It's like, you know, in the high, like 40-something percent in major prison-holding states like Texas and California are going in for just routine violations, which is they, you know, they smoke some weed and they get drug tested, and conditions of their parole are that they're not supposed to smoke marijuana, and so boom, back in for a year or whatever. You miss a date with your parole officer, back in. So it produces prisoners by producing these infractions and producing, you know, sort of officially generated recidivism in which people really haven't committed important crimes. I mean, clearly, no matter how you feel about marijuana, and I know you guys generally up there in the Canadian Pacific Northwest have a kind of civilized view of marijuana. But, you know, I mean, even if one has some sort of backward view about marijuana and that it should be illegal, I mean, one would have to admit that missing a date with a parole officer is itself not actually a crime. I mean, there's not that much harm done to society. But, you know, that can land you back in state prison for a year in California or Texas or New York or Illinois. The prison produces actual social harm, actual criminal behavior, and it also produces the category and the legal mechanisms of recidivism, of just turning, you know, people who are no harm to others back into prisoners.
I want to talk about an interesting relationship that I think, well, a person can be incarcerated for stealing a loaf of bread, which, you know, if someone was hungry, I would personally not consider that a crime in a world where so many are denied the basic essentials. But a company can destroy an entire ecosystem and the entire livelihood of thousands of people and not be held criminal. Can you talk to this? To me, paradox.
In some ways, it's not really a paradox, right? I mean, it's a class society. Capitalism is a class society, and the government is both a mechanism of social control and an arena of social struggle. So there is some democratic accountability. You know, the legislative branch of governments in the United States are definitely, to some extent, democratically accountable. Popular forces can have influence on shaping policy, and the history of progressive reform in the United States is that history of popular progressive forces through direct action and protest and strikes and elections and operating in office, changing the laws, creating decent policy. But, you know, at another level, fundamentally, the state in a capitalist society is about reproducing the capitalist economic system, which has the capitalist class and the institutions that they operate through, corporations, at the heart of its agenda. And so, you know, this sort of legal criminality is part and parcel of the system. And, I mean, it shouldn't be a surprise. That doesn't mean we should accept it, of course. But, yeah, this is what happens when corporations are allowed to write the laws. And so, you know, I'm sure most of your listeners understand how that works. It's just like the privileges of vast economic power deliver these sorts of benefits. Be one a rich individual able to, you know, hire decent lawyers and delay, and beat some charges, or whether it's an institution that's such as BP, you know, getting away with hiding the evidence of the damage they've created in the Gulf due to their oil spill and negotiating what will probably turn out to be a penalty that's really, you know, a fraction of the overall cost to the government and the communities that depend on the ecosystem of the Gulf. And, of course, you can never actually, at a certain level, put a true economic value on an ecosystem. But, you know, to the extent that large parts of the regional economy depend on that ecosystem, you know, the damage is going to be far greater than what BP is, you know, eventually going to pay out through all of this. So, you know, this is what it appears to be. I mean, and I don't really, in my book, I don't really talk about white-collar crime. And I also don't talk about political violence, because those, to me, don't really require that much explanation. They are what they appear to be: large corporations using money to bend the law in their favor so they don't have to go to jail, pay fines, et cetera, et cetera. So, too, with political violence. Remember once when some talk, you know, based on Lockdown America, a former political prisoner asked, why don't you deal with political prisoners more? I said, well, because it is what it appears to be. I mean, why were the radical left, you know, armed elements of the 60s put in jail, hunted down by the FBI and put in jail? Because they challenged the state with violence. I mean, what is there to explain? You can then decide whether you think that's effective. You can decide whether you like their politics or don't like them, but like, what is mysterious about that? It is what it appears to be. A group of people challenged the state, and the state, with its overwhelming power, fought them and won and crushed them and used the prison system and the criminal justice system to do that. But prison, general prison population, it's not so clear. Why are there 2.3 million people in prison and, you know, upwards of 6 million people under the direct supervision of the criminal justice system, either out on parole or probation, having to, you know, take drug tests and check in daily or check in weekly or wear electronic monitoring bracelets, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, why all of this? And why did this buildup begin in the 1970s and go through to now? Why were prison rates generally, the rates of incarceration generally stable from the end of the Civil War through to the 60s, and then suddenly there's this huge explosion? And so that is not as self-evidently apparent. You know, it's driving causes. So that's what I tried to explain. And it's, as you said in the beginning, you know, it's linked to the shift away from Keynesianism, away from a sort of burgeoning social democracy in the United States, rooted in the New Deal and Johnson's war on poverty, and a shift away from that towards neoliberal economic theory, you know, out with Keynes, in with Hayek and Friedman, and the idea that the state should remove itself from the economy. Of course, this idea is then violated in times of crisis and banks are bailed out, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, the theory is that the state must remove itself from economic activity, and first to go is like, you know, social spending on all of the programs that support the working classes, assistance for healthcare, education, job training, et cetera, et cetera. And why was there that shift beginning in the late 70s and really taking off beginning in 1980 with the election of Ronald Reagan? It has to do with the fact that the world capitalist system in the 1970s faced a profit crisis. And from the end of World War II until the 1970s, the golden era of world capitalism, you saw across the West rising wages, a rising standard of living for the working class, at the same time that there were rising taxes, high rates of growth, and also really robust corporate profits. And so corporations and the capitalist class were okay, more or less, with the Keynesian compromise because they could afford it. They could still make really quite record rates of profit. Those profits, the sort of average across the economy after-tax profit rates, peak in the mid-late 60s and then decline precipitously into the early 70s, and that's when there's a rethink starting in 73. There really is a shift away from Keynesianism towards neoliberalism. So what was the cause of that profit crisis? It was basically that the world capitalist economy had finally recovered economically from World War II, that the devastation of World War II was so profound that it basically took a generation to rebuild the other two poles of world capitalism, Europe and Asia, centered around Japan. And once that recovery was sort of mature and those core capitalist economies were built out, you had a classic crisis of overproduction, a crisis of overaccumulation. There was too much capital, too much money to lend, too many factories to produce blue jeans, washing machines, whatever else, electronics, and not enough demand for it, unless there was going to be some sort of radical kind of like deepening of the Keynesian compromise and an acceptance of low profit rates. The choice facing the capitalist class to restore their profit rates was to attack the working class so that the portion of the general social surplus produced by the economy as a whole that went directly and indirectly through, as wages and as benefits and social spending to the working classes, that had to be reduced so they got less so the capitalist class could get more, thus to restore profits. And that's exactly what the program of neoliberalism is and was. Cut tax rates on the highest income earners, cut corporate tax rates, allow for an expansion of loopholes, et cetera, facilitate the upward redistribution of wealth, and attack directly and indirectly all the facets of power of the working classes, attack labor. So, you know, so Reagan did. First thing he did was he comes in, he fires the air traffic controllers union, 11,000 people went on strike, and he fired them, and he was able to do this because actually a lot of them worked at government facilities, and, you know, then stacked the National Labor Relations Board with people who were totally hostile to labor, and those are the direct assaults on working class power. And then indirectly, you know, there began this whole discourse of the culture of poverty, that, you know, the kind of racist myth-making and baiting about welfare queens, et cetera, et cetera. And so the whole population, not the whole population, but large parts of popular opinion really turned against the poor, turned against this new kind of imagined image of the poor as lazy parasites extracting unearned income from the hardworking masses. And so you get this sort of perfect stand-in. I mean, it's actually the actual rentier class collecting dividends fits the, you know, they are the parasites essentially, and instead, you know, and the working classes do experience this extraction of from their labors, but then they are taught to falsely imagine that this is going to welfare queens and lazy people in the ghetto, et cetera, et cetera. And so there was like then a kind of actual popular consent built around the project of militarization, repression, incarceration of the inner cities, the highways, and increasingly all of America. I mean, this country is so over-policed, it's ridiculous. So there we are. We're still in the neoliberal moment, and There were moments where this was right before 9/11. There was definitely a rethink was underway, and it was creeping into sort of elite opinion making institutions like the New York Times and NBC. You know, were reporting on the criminal justice system in very, you know, not politicized Marxist terms as I just laid out for you, but in, you know, very, very critically, you know, about the human rights violations, et cetera, et cetera. And you actually saw incarceration rates in the U.S. begin to plateau and dip right before 9/11. And then, in the name of the war on terror, we get a whole new round of fear and paranoia and massive, massive federal largesse to any and all state and local police institutions to buy new equipment for surveillance, incarceration, and policing. And so, you know, the situation in a lot of America is that the schools are totally underfunded and the cops have more gear than they know what to do with.
I want to talk, though, about the sustaining forces behind it, because while we understand, and thank you for making those points very clear, the relationship between this war on terror and the insecurity that it creates in the population, the way that people self-surveillance themselves and perhaps do not resist when they would otherwise, right? Because you create this culture of fear and everybody's running scared. And when we're all scared, well, business goes on as usual. Facing that fact, people in Latin America, we're seeing it more and more in Europe, we've seen it in other parts of the world, in Africa, are rising up and standing up. And I wonder if you could comment on this, because it seems to me that within the capitalist system, we're always going to be back to this, you know, 3 steps forward, 10 steps back, right? We get Keynesianism, then we get neoliberalism. You know, the next stage, right now, we have a world where these practices of the war on terror, the war on drugs, are being systematized. So there's this interchanging of information, interlinking. They're united. What's it going to take for us to unite our efforts and resist this?
That's the key question, and I really don't have an answer. I don't have an answer to, like, well, what social movements need to do is X, Y, Z. I do not know. But I can say that I'm hopeful. I mean, I guess there's one thing I could add. But first of all, let me just say I'm very hopeful about this moment of protest. And I don't know what the correct thing for social movements to do is. Those strategies and tactics have to be worked out by the people in specific places, engaged in real specific struggles. But one thing I would say, as an intellectual, I mean, my job is, I mean, I've been an activist, but I don't deign to sort of claim that mantle. I'm not really an activist anymore. I mean, I'm a scholar. I teach at a graduate institute and write books, and I'm a reporter. And it's like, so one thing I would say is, I think we really have to take ideas and history seriously. I'm increasingly disturbed by how little history is in curriculum. I'm also increasingly disturbed by the role of technology. There's a whole kind of techno-bureaucratic enclosure of education, and people are increasingly concerned with the form of things and not their content. And I think that one major problem that the U.S. left faces is a lack of intellectually robust engagement with political economy and history, and that we too often resort to sort of moral explanations, individualistic categories, sort of methodological individualism to explain problems. We seek direct economistic explanations for things, and then that mentality lends itself to conspiracy theories that can sometimes be really wild and out there and really not helpful. And that the whole practice of analyzing and criticizing capitalist society and political economy requires, you know, a kind of thinking that we generally don't do. And part of it is that there's a very sort of utilitarian mentality, in, at least down here, this side of the border. People want to know what information is useful. What should we do about this? Let's critique this in a way that's actionable now. That's all good, that kind of tactical knowledge. But we also need to have a deeper critique of the society, and that's not easy to do. That requires study and requires specifically reading history and thinking about institutions, about the large patterns in history, about the large long-term patterns of political economy, and to think amorally, you know, have one's ethics and morals clear. But when you approach a problem, think totally amorally about it. If you don't find the evidence that you want, accept it, confront it, move on. And that's getting back to my original comments. People look at this prison thing, and they're like, oh, it must be private prisons. Oh, it's prison labor. It's like, it's not. There are only 7% of beds are being run by private prisons. There's, you know, very few prisoners actually work for private corporations. Many of them work for state corporations, but that's about managing prisons. That's about making prison look efficient. The military makes stuff in federal prisons. It would be much cheaper for the military to buy that stuff on the open market. It's not about money making. You know, yes, there are interests that make money off of prisons. Yes, they lobby for repressive legislation. But all of this was not produced by that alone. Those parasitic interest groups are actually much more produced by the policy shift than the reverse of them having the private prisons and the guards having produced this profound, massive, now, you know, 35-year-old shift in U.S. criminal justice policy. So, you know, moving away from economistic and moralistic explanations to think more historically and amorally, and that doesn't mean you act immorally, but just to think really, really harshly, clearly about stuff, I think that's one thing that we could do better and do more of. Now, as for the rest of it, I defer to the comrades who are taking all the risks and, you know, devoting so much time to all this meetings and organizing, and I applaud them tremendously.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Dr. Christian Parenti. He's the author of 4 books, Lockdown America, Police and Prisons in the Age of Crisis, The Soft Cage, Surveillance in America from Slavery to War on Terror, The Freedom, Shadows and Hallucinations in Occupy Iraq, and his latest, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you, Sylvia, and talk to you again soon about Tropic of Chaos, hopefully.
Yes, thank you very much,
hope
and talk to you soon.
Okay.
Look forward. Bye-bye.
Bye.